Hi, hello, it's Vin. Thank you so much for listening to The Vin and Ali Show. We've created something that we're really excited about and we want to share it with you. It's called Recalibrate. It's a 12-step process that helps you create more clarity and more alignment in your life. It's the exact approach that both Ali and I have been using to live happier lives and to achieve all of our wildest dreams in the last 7 years. It's been crazy. Being one of our loyal listeners, we wanted to share a special something with you. Visit recalibrate.online/Vin and Ali to access the course for 70% off. I hope you will check it out. Anyway, let's dive into this episode.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Vin and Ali Show. On this particular episode, we're going to be reviewing the classic, the legend, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey.
Yeah.
We're debating, is it Stephen Covey or Stephen Covey?
Yeah.
Covey?
We'll get him to clarify.
Covey?
Yeah.
Well, he's a great bloke anyway.
Yeah.
This book.
We don't know that.
Well, let's assume he is.
Okay.
Because we're reviewing the book.
We're going biased.
Sorry, we've just come from lunch. We had a lot of hot and spicy Korean chicken, so we're a little bit jittery from the spice. Yeah. Look, this book, we're going to do our best to go through all 7 habits of highly effective people.
Yeah.
And let's see how we go. Let's see how far we get down this list of 7. Bit of context. I reckon this was definitely top 5 books that I've ever read. Not best 5 books I've read, though I think it could make that list. I'm not sure. I haven't thought about it. But what I am going to say is it was one of the first 5 books I've ever read. That's what I meant.
It went from the top 5 to the first 5.
Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, what an endorsement.
Yeah, what an endorsement.
Wow.
It's a great one. I'm just trying to be more precise with what I was trying to say. Yeah. Post-lunch match.
Yeah.
Now,
sharp.
It was definitely one of the first 5 books I've ever read. And I got to tell you, what I loved about it, first of all, is that it was very straightforward. It was very simple. And I loved that about this book. Yeah. And so I definitely read this when I was in my late teens and it had a dramatic impact on my life.
Love that.
It helped me socially. Mm. It helped me learn how to navigate the social dynamics, you know, in high school and then in university, et cetera. Yeah, it gave me a good framework. It's funny. We said that our last podcast episode.
Did you read many books like this when you were in your teens?
I was given this book by my uncle Car.
Yeah, well.
We spoke about it before the podcast where he's not an actual car. He's a person and his name's Car.
No one said he was a car.
No, but when I said it, you looked at me and I was like, "I know my uncle's not a vehicle. He doesn't have 4 wheels. He's a person.
Yeah.
His name's just Car.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's not actually a car.
So, yeah, he's...
Person.
I'm picturing a car, but that's
cool. Well, he gave me this book. He gave me Richest Man in Babylon.
Yeah.
He gave me How to Win Friends and Influence People.
This is a good book.
Yeah, he's a pearl. Yeah. But I did not understand the value of them when I read them.
Yeah.
Because you're in your late teens, man. Your brain hasn't even developed. The only thing you care about is gaming and trying to get a girlfriend. So I didn't really understand the value that was behind these books that he gave me. But
That's awesome. I love that because I only started reading books like this probably late 20s. And I always wondered what it was like. Yeah.
So you came late. So you would have understood the weight behind them as you were consuming them in your late 20s.
Well, I was trying to apply them live.
Wow.
While I was reading them, especially the first few. I pretty much went from never reading any books post-university or even pre-university to when I started the business in like 2014. One of the things I wrote down is read 1,000 books over the next 10 years.
That's crazy.
Right? So, and then I'm like, and I pretty much had a note where it was like, okay, aim for that and then just see what the body of knowledge looks like at different points. And then probably got to, I think, about 600 odd at the moment.
Wow.
And I think after about 450.
What a flex. I've read 600 books. What a flex.
3 times speed on Audible. It doesn't even count.
Have you seen that?
It's like,
have you seen that
guy?
And he just
flicks the books. And I read it.
I read the book. That was a great meme.
Oh, so good. And I think probably after, a few hundred diminishing returns kicks in, especially when you're reading around similar areas. But
and quick call out on that too. It's not the number of books that you read, man. It's really about if you pick the right books, you could. But there's no way you'd know what the right one's for you unless you read the 600, right? Yeah. But what I've looked at as well is that when I reflect on the books that I've read, I could just pick 20 and just reread them every single damn year, and that would help me crush life.
Yeah.
So again, yeah, just to call that out, it's not about flexing. No. I've read 600 books. No. Yeah, because it's not about the number
after
of them,
a little period of time when you're reading. Yeah. It's more for thinking is what I found. Right, right. It wasn't even for learning or acquiring that knowledge. And funnily enough, the books that I actually go back to, a lot of them were really early on, probably in the first 50 or 100 of those that I really liked.
Yeah.
And I think you get drawn to the books that are going to have the most impact as well. But
It's to me now, reading is like having a different perspective come into my life. That's helpful.
For sure.
So for example, parenting, I've been reading a couple of books on parenting and that just, it's like the background voice, it helps you navigate some of those difficult situations. Because you're like, actually, I'm going through this right now. How do I navigate this? Oh, this person said 20 years worth of experience with this. And you just downloaded 20 years worth of experience in that moment and can make better decisions.
For sure.
Funny though, this book, when I read it, it was kind of shoved down my throat.
Yeah.
Whereas you were thirsty for it.
Yeah.
You were the horse that was thirsty for water. I had the water, but didn't want to drink it, but was forced to drink it. That's why it was interesting revisiting this, because I was like, wow, reading these again, some bits are completely, like when I read it when I was younger, just straight across my head.
Do you still think it had an impact though, based on the lessons? Like if you look back on it, are you like, I'm so glad I got that force down my throat?
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, just a little immature there, Ali. Why are we laughing? I don't know why we're laughing.
I repeated what you just said before. How's it immature when I say it, but it's perfectly fine when you say it.
But it sounds different when you say it. I don't know. It just sounds different. Yeah. Move on. Let's not get cancelled. Let's get into it.
Let's do it.
All right. So the first rule or the first habit of highly effective people, be proactive.
Yeah.
Now, I just got the definition here of proactive as well for myself.
Yeah.
And it's creating or controlling a situation rather than responding to it after it has happened. So creating or controlling a situation rather than just responding to it after it has happened. What does that mean for you when it comes to being proactive?
Yeah, for sure. Like I always think about it like what it's the opposite to it. Right, which is reactive. So, and it was funny, we were talking about this at lunch and I kind of mentioned, I'm like, I don't know whether this book, like the principles are just so sound and universal and natural, or if this book actually had such a big impact without me even realizing when I read it, because I think that's just one where if I look back over my last like 8 to 10 years, I think proactivity is just a really strong value. And to me, being proactive is, having an element of control in the way that you think, act, make decisions rather than being reactive. And maybe it's just based on, I grew up as an only child, my upbringing as well, where I think proactiveness is maybe quite a natural tendency where I like sort of, where I can call the shots or lead the direction a little bit. So, and I actually feel weird when I have to be reactive for too long a period of time. So that's kind of where I probably sit on that side with proactivity. One of the really cool things when I was reading this chapter was digging into, like, he uses the example of the golden eggs that come from the goose, right? And it's based on one of Aesop's fables, where it's essentially like there's a story of this goose that every day it lays one golden egg, right? So the owner's like, this is amazing. Like, wow, we're getting these eggs, gets super rich, and then gets the great idea that, hey, you know what? I'm just going to kill the goose and just get all the eggs right now rather than having to wait for one every single day, right? And it uses two words. It's like P/PC. And one is, and he says it's like pretty much the goose is a producer. And then the PC is the production capability, right? So that goose was, I don't know if I'm butchering the story, the goose essentially can do one egg every single day. That's its capacity. And it's like, I think it just applies to so many different parts of life where we get a little bit too greedy or we want to extract the most value we can out of this thing. And then we don't actually nurture the goose that's actually creating all of the golden eggs.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really powerful element of proactivity as well. It's like not only trying to eat all the fruit of the tree, but then also nourishing the tree that underpins that.
We talked about this literally just a few days ago with my marketing campaign and with my business, where we were talking about how if I take too much out of the business now, that's kind of killing the goose, right? So it's that balance of reinvesting and that's interesting. That's a really interesting kind of perspective on being proactive.
Yeah. So it's not only around taking positive action and planning, call it. Like when I think of proactivity as well, I think about strategy, I think about planning, I think about decision-making, I think about prioritizing, right? They're all great as well. But then it's also how do you then manage it all so that it's all being nourished as well.
It's interesting that when you were younger, you used to be someone, like you've always been like this. Whereas when I reflect on when I was younger, I think I was someone who was very reactive.
Yeah.
I wasn't proactive. So you're saying you've been always proactive?
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I think proactive is nearly too positive a word, but definitely like trying to lead or control the actions that were going around me. I don't know how effective I was when I was younger at it, but I definitely wasn't too reactive. Like I've never had too much of an inflow where I'm like, oh, yep, I better do that now because I got to do it. And like any of that stuff, it's generally just been like, yeah, I'm either keen or I'm not. You know, even when I went to school, I was like, yeah, probably not going today. You know, like that was that was my version of a proactive move. Now I don't know whether that's a really good move or not.
Yeah.
But anything that was like dealt with like authority or somebody telling me what to do. I think nowadays you'd just probably call it was ADHD, right? Mm. Like just very undiagnosed what we had there where anytime somebody's like, hey, you need to do that, the default was, nah, probably not going to happen.
But I love how you're so polite about it. Yeah. It's like, nah, probably not.
Yeah. It's like,
thank you for the suggestion.
My mum used to say, she's like, you always say yes to stuff, but then the stuff that you're never going to do, you just actually don't do. So she's like, you're like, want to be nice. So it's like a default yes. But then there's just certain things that you will do and certain that you won't. And they're pretty consistent. And I'm like, I don't know what that is.
Well, it's interesting because when I reflect on the word proactive and I look at this habit as be proactive, I just reflect on the fact that when I was younger, I was so reactive.
Yeah.
And in being reactive, I just never felt like I had any control. I felt like I had no control of the situation. And I just remember I always would say things like this. I would always say things like, there's nothing I can do about it.
Yeah.
You know, I have to go to math school on Saturdays. There's nothing I can do about it. I just have to go, you know, and same thing with, again, when I was in my later years in high school, there's nothing I can do about it. I can't write. I want to be a teacher because, you know, in my community, in my family, I've got to write pharmacist or, you know, accountant.
I've already got my list of what I have to write.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's just, I felt I couldn't be proactive because there were so many cultural pressures.
Yeah.
And I was confined within this box.
Yeah.
So then I was just reacting to everybody else's proactiveness, you know, and I couldn't. Yeah. Yeah, so I didn't feel like, so to me, when I think of be proactive, I think take control as opposed to give away control.
Yeah. And I think we both probably grew up with the two extremes of it.
Yeah.
Where like you probably had an oversubscription and I probably had an undersubscription.
Interesting.
And then we had to like figure it out a little bit to find a balance.
Because you needed some subscription and I need a little less.
That's right. I needed more structure. I probably need a little bit more guidance, a little bit more discipline because like I'll put quotation marks here, my proactive moves probably weren't really serving me there for a very long period of time, right? But then your reactive moves, probably now I see you today, you're so disciplined. You're able to focus in. You're able to complete projects really well. So it might just be one of those things where like our environment naturally maybe dictates some of this and then we adjust it as we grow.
It just makes me think of kids when they're born, they're definitely reactive. So I think we start at reactive and then hopefully our environment teaches us the importance of being more proactive.
Yeah. For sure. The parents are definitely reactive when you have a kid. It's like there's not really all that much you could do in the early parts of that journey. So maybe it's just different chapters, different parts of life.
Yeah, which requires different skills.
Yeah.
And I mean, highly effective people, this is what the book's talking about. I can't imagine there being any highly effective people who are five.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think your boys, Marcel and Romeo, I don't think they're highly effective people now, nor is Xander.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that comes with time, comes with age, comes with, it's like anything, right? When I look at all of these particular traits that Stephen talks about, man, you fall off the bandwagon, you get back on the bandwagon, you fall off it, you're good at it for some periods of life, and then you're bad at it for other periods of life. You're good at it in some areas of your life, and then you're bad at it in some areas of your life. So the question and the reason why I bring that up is there an area of your life where you think you're not as proactive? And are there areas of your life where you think you're super proactive?
Yeah. Yeah, great question. Do you have any off the top
of your
head?
For sure.
Right, you start.
So, for sure, that's why I asked the question. Yeah. I was hoping you'd direct them back towards me. Yeah.
I knew you wanted it. I know, this is like an alley-oop where you just throw it up for yourself and then you dunk it.
I threw it up, you're about to run. I'm like, I've got this. I threw it to myself, yeah.
I'm like, he knows I'm fully proactive. It's like, why would he ask such a question?
Well, I'm trying to get you to be more vulnerable too.
No, I will.
I think where I'm very proactive is in my business life. And we know this, I mean, because I've talked about it for a long time. I think I'm very proactive in my business life. I'm not very proactive in my personal life. It's weird. I've been trying to improve that a lot, you know, and I think I've made some good improvements, but I want to get better at it, especially in my, when it comes to health. You know, if you listen to the podcast, you've heard me bring this up many times. I definitely fall behind in that health category. You know, it's even to the point where you've brought it up to me and you said, hey, bro, I think you just don't care about it. I think it's just not that important to you. And then like that, I was like, oh, do I really not care about it? Or is it just, I haven't prioritized it. No. And I'm definitely not proactive enough. You know, I've been told, I told us early Jan, I was going to look for a PT. You haven't done it yet. Mm. I'm not proactive there. Mm. Right. So it's like, okay. But it's interesting. I'm still trying to navigate and get better at that.
Yeah.
But that's clear example in my life.
Yeah, for sure. I think the one that came up for me probably there is, I think, family life.
Mm.
You know, I think that one can just get into the motions a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas I look at other areas, like if it's attached to a hobby or
super proactive.
Yeah, like really proactive on those moves. Whereas it's like I think I really struggle with proactivity in actually the more recurring aspects of life and the things that are actually quite stable and secure.
Right.
That's where I could definitely improve my proactivity.
But it's good to have awareness for that, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's a trap we all fall for, not just you fall for, but any area. See, I take for granted my health.
Mm.
It's the thing that you have all the time. Yeah. I love this quote. I can't remember what it is. It's from Naval.
Yep.
It says, a healthy person wants 10,000 things. A sick person just wants one thing.
Yeah.
And it's that I really don't want to wait to that point where you go to the doctor and they just... They say something to you, and then that forever just changes your life, right? So, yeah, this is me just reminding myself it's important. Get on it, Vin.
Yeah, we'll play this back to you. We'll
I need to play it back to myself.
Yeah, but I think it's cool. It's cool to reflect on these things.
Mm.
And is there any areas where you're reactive, like at a high level where, it causes you a bit of friction?
When the opportunities come in. Because right now the amount of opportunities that come in are quite frequent, almost on a daily basis now. Things are coming in through my email and my inbox. Super reactive to that.
Yeah.
Super reactive. Don't like where I'm at currently, headspace wise with it. Mm. Because even though I'm saying no to the majority of them, if it doesn't come in, I start to feel anxious.
Yeah.
How weird is that? I don't want it.
Yeah.
But I still want the inquiries to come up. It's like, no, stop, but keep it coming. It's super weird. It's super, super weird, right?
I love that.
It's so weird because but I'm super reactive there.
Yeah.
Where I always feel like with those opportunities, I have to be really quick to respond, even though I'm saying no.
Yeah, I like that.
It's kind of, why do you like it?
No, because that's a cool framing. It's like knowing where do you need to be, where do you feel you always have to be quick?
Because that's reactive. Yeah.
Right? Because you pretty much put all the other things that are really important to the side because it's like, I better address this right now if it's hot or it's like reactive or you've got pressure perceived or not.
Another spot, anytime anyone in my inner circle is unhappy, I'm super reactive to that too.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen often.
Yeah.
Which means I think if it doesn't happen often, it means maybe I'm being proactive enough.
Yeah.
Where I'm able to mitigate some of those situations.
Mm.
Yeah. What about you? Any area where you feel like, oh, you're super reactive?
Reactive, I would say, funnily enough, and this sounds really weird, like I think I've got a system where like emails are pretty mitigated.
Yeah, that's so good.
But just when I see an email, I can't unsee it. Right. So, and as soon as I have like an unsolved problem in the back of my mind, that will just keep eating away at me until it's solved. So it can be big or small or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think I could be a little bit reactive. Like every day I need to finish the day with nothing in the inbox.
Really? Yeah. So you get to inbox zero every day?
Every day, zero.
That's That's pretty legendary.
Right.
But you probably get one email a day.
Yeah, it's a pretty low inflow, to be honest.
Yeah, mine's very high.
But inflow. It's been designed like that.
Yeah,
too, right? Like so,
and you're being proactive in designing it like that.
Yeah, potentially, or I'm just missing out on a lot of really important emails. But yeah, I think that's one is that I'm a little bit reactive. Like I hate things running in the back of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very much like I either want to resolve something, like act on it, or like park it, properly. So that's where like I'll put it into Asana or a project management tool just so that it's in the extension of the brain rather than inside my mind and body at any given time.
You know the danger of being reactive is you end up playing checkers.
Yeah.
You play move by move, whereas you're not playing chess. Chess players play 10, 20, 30 moves ahead. They play the whole game after one move, right?
For sure.
And I think what I'm really thinking about now is the areas where I am being reactive, I'm not being strategic.
Yep.
I'm not able to achieve goals in that area because I'm just moving one checker piece at a time, man. And what I've learned in the game of business as well as in life is that the more strategy you can have behind what you do, far out, the outcomes are generally incredible. However, you've just got to avoid being reactive because reactive means you're playing checkers.
Yeah, for sure.
So it's almost like doing an audit. Where in our lives are we reactive? Hey, you're actually playing checkers in those areas.
Yeah.
And
we always like
framing it like that.
We always call it out, right? I love it. It's probably nearly the biggest compliment I can give someone where I'm like, hey, it looks like you're playing chess right now. Because you can see people having multiple ways that they can win, thinking a few moves ahead.
Yeah.
I love watching that play out. Like even when you make certain moves or you launch products, like I think you're pretty organically very good at chess, right?
No,
like,
there's quite a few areas in my life where I'm playing checkers.
Yeah, but when you do decide to play chess, and like I've seen you do it, it's like, wow, you're going to win here on multiple fronts because now your chessboard's set. And I think that's just one of the coolest things that I love watching.
Mm.
I love watching like those games unfold.
Okay.
Where, like there's a guy, Sam Canavan, who works for ClassPass that's an advisor of us. I love the way he thinks. He thinks like chess as well.
He's a chess strategist.
Like you see strategy play out a few moves ahead. Then when people can actually explain the moves, as they were playing out, I'm like, hey, that's cool.
Method behind the madness.
Yeah, it's like, hey, this is how it was going to play out.
Well, let me ask you this then. If you find yourself playing checkers, how do you get out of that?
You have to learn how to play chess.
Damn, that was profound. I had to lean back for a second there.
But I think we all start off playing checkers.
Oh, for sure.
Right? And then checkers is the game that really easy to understand.
Yeah,
right?
One move at a time.
Chess requires, like, if I think about it, it's like Daniel Kahneman stuff. You know, where it's like system one and system two thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Like checkers, if you just become really, really good at checkers, it just means that there's another part of the brain that isn't really activated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chess part of the mind that needs to do that. And it does. It requires a deeper level of thinking and strategy, and you need to maybe get some coaching and learn some moves. And then look, some people just love checkers, right? So play checkers. Chess maybe isn't for everyone.
Well, but I mean, I'm thinking in a sense that if I was actually trying to get better at strategy, then I would play against other people who are playing chess.
Yeah.
You know, and what I mean by that pragmatically is, let's say I was building a career as a magician, I would look for a magician who's actually clearly executing very high level strategies, like their social media is going great or they're doing different things, they're gaining thousands of followers every week. Sure. I'd find these people that are getting results that you can tell externally from someone who's playing chess. And then I'll try to learn from them.
For sure. And I think just spending time with people that are good at strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
That helps as well.
Definitely.
Right? Because you could spend time with the best magician.
But that's doesn't mean they're good at strategy.
What you're talking about there is like, okay, now I've looked at you collectively.
Yeah.
It's like there's obviously some chess going on here. Like you've got the good shows, you're booking out the big venues, you've got the best, are they tricks? Is that what you call them? What's the word?
What did you say?
Tricks.
Tricks, yeah.
Yeah. I thought that was like a more professional word for them. Illusions or something.
Wow, that was weird.
I got weird there.
How dare you call them tricks?
I know there's a sensitive group of magicians out there that I really don't want to mess with here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not an enemy I'm looking to find. But I think it's looking at it like that way, right? I remember a few years ago doing that, funnily enough, actually with chess. Like I never really played chess, but I'm like, hey, this is a great strategy game, and spending time just with a few really good chess players, like grandmasters, and I just wanted to see how they thought. and what their thinking process was.
Well, if we just play with that analogy a little longer, the way they get good at strategy is they think about the game. They think about the game.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the times, if we're playing checkers, we don't think about the game until we're playing the game.
Yeah.
Whereas they think about the game before they play the game. They think about the game while they're playing the game. They think about the game after they play the game.
Yeah.
And to me, that's how you kind of get better at strategy. Is you need to think about your actions while you're taking them, being aware. And then after that, even afterwards, reflect and review. And even before you do it, you plan. So it's, to me, the way to get out of that reactive world is to be more intentional about what you're doing. Think multiple moves ahead, if possible. And once you've made those moves, reflect on them too.
Yeah. And one of the cool things is thinking back to the chess example, the way that a lot of them kind of explained how they got better is that they actually have tactics, right? So they don't think about the whole strategy of the game. They break it down based on like the start of the game, the middle of the game, and the end game, right? So they've got the openings, then they've got the end games. And then they're just, it's just repetition, right? They do so many gambits and they play so many different tactics that automatically after you start doing it for even 20, 30 hours, rather than only seeing one or two, because at the beginning, you just think about how did the pieces move, right? They're not thinking about that, right? They're now thinking about, okay, where do I end up in four spots? And that's just purely from pattern recognition. And I think that's how you ultimately become better at strategy, is you get that repetition in through just examples and case studies. Like, you can't just be like, hey, today I'm going to be a great strategist.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work like that. It has to be done through a sequence, I think, of testing and iteration as well.
That's why I think one of the greatest things you've done as well is with Future Golf, you're bringing in lots of intelligence. You're bringing in lots of people who are, they have lots of strategies in their mind. You bring them in for a strategy day. You bring four or five people from all these different industries coming together in one room. And then you're sitting there with basically five chess masters showing you how to play your chessboard. Yeah. And then some of them will have bad ideas. Some of them will have good ideas. And you're like, hey, actually, that's we'd never thought about this. That is super cool. And like, you've inspired me to do that in my business as well, bringing all these different people in and they see moves you can't see.
Sure.
You know, and if you get to the point in your business where you can be proactive and you can bring in these different perspectives, that's such an elite move.
Absolutely.
Injecting more intelligence into the business. Otherwise, generally, guess what? Most entrepreneurs, the only intelligence we have is our own.
For sure. And it's not only that though, like when you put groups of people like that together, sometimes the chemistry works as well.
The hive mind forms.
And they multiply.
They multiply. Because one person will say something, build on something. And then there's also creation of new strategies in the moment.
It's cool.
Because when masters come together, new strategies are formed.
Well, you see stand-up comedians do it. Like
when in the green room.
Right? Kevin Hart and all these. I was like, I'm pretty sure most of the top stand-up comedians have a group of 6 to 8 writers sitting there helping them put it together, right?
For sure.
And it probably exists in every form of life. Like, to be ahead of the game or elite, it's usually based on the input of a number of very elite players.
I'll round out this first habit by saying that whether it's for business or for life, always try to be proactive and try to bring in strategists who are more experienced than you to have them have a look at what you're doing, because they will be able to see the 80-20 moves, the 20% you change that gives you 80% of the results. And I think that's one of the most powerful things I've learned and watched you do that I'm starting to do way more now in my life. It's powerful, man. It's so powerful.
It's finding a nice balance between, I think, strategy and tactical execution as well. That's the magic.
If your strategy, I think, I can't remember I'm forgetting quotes. It's crazy. But it's, if you're all strategy and no execution, you don't go anywhere.
No.
But if you're all execution and no strategy, you end up in the wrong place.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Love that.
Second habit.
So cool.
Begin with the end in mind.
Oh, hello. This is a good
one. Why are you helloing to that?
I'm just helloing.
Yeah, I feel like you said that redundantly for no reason.
Thank you for calling that out.
I'm calling that out because the cool thing about doing these in person.
Yeah, I know. I was literally just saying hello. Yeah, like, I was excited that we were in the same room at the moment.
Hi, Ali.
Yeah.
Welcome to the podcast after 20 minutes. Begin with the end in mind was one that I kind of battled with a little bit because that's not easy to do.
Yeah.
And I feel like the end only becomes clear as you begin. That's why I don't know. Am I getting too philosophical and Alan Watts about this? But it just feels like begin with the end in mind. But how do I begin with something in my mind that I can only get once I've begun? Do you know what I mean?
I love that.
Yeah. Let's jam on that because that one made this one really hard because I know what this one's saying.
Yeah.
This one is trying to help you gain clarity.
Yeah.
That's what this lesson is all about. Like, just get clear on what you're doing and everything becomes easier. Mm. But clarity doesn't come at the start. Mm. Clarity always comes at the end. So how do you start with the end? Because if you're starting at the end, that means you're just ending.
Yeah.
There's no start point. I don't know.
I like it. I like the level of depth that you went in on it. I pretty much
just, or stupidity.
Yeah.
Or stupidity.
So we don't go too esoteric on it. The way that I view this is it's just more about vision, right?
Okay.
And thinking about, it's nearly like saying rather than just going off and just starting to, like, again, it probably aligns with what you said. Like, yeah you can probably just start and you can do a heap of stuff and then you'll get clarity on the journey of doing. But this is more just like, okay, well, what's the next milestone look like? Well, what do I actually want this thing to look and feel like at the end of it?
Right? Well, hang on though.
Yeah.
Because what that means is you've got to have a pretty decent operating system in your brain before you can do this. Right? Because this is more advice, I believe, for someone who's maybe in their 30s, mid-30s. Yeah? Hang with me for a second. Because if you're 18, how the hell can you start with the end in mind? If you talk to my 18-year-old self and you said, by the time you're 30, you're going to be a keynote speaker, I'm like, get out of here, man. What the hell is a keynote speaker, right? So I couldn't have started with that end in mind.
Yeah.
So to me, starting with
and
the end in mind.
And how far into the future are you going with the end,
I'm just saying 10 years. I'm just saying 10 years or even 5 years. Yeah. I couldn't even see that far. Mm. And to me, it's for people in the middle of their life. This is great because now hopefully you've developed a powerful enough operating system to be able to see, you know, maybe 5 years. Even then, I doubt most people can see beyond that. But when you're young, clarity only comes from doing. You need to go do more doing. You need to do more things before the clarity comes.
Throw the dart.
Because this is why I always try to play the other side of it, where I think this is dangerous advice for an 18-year-old.
Yep.
Because if you tell them to start with the end in mind, that's basically the school system now saying you have to choose exactly what you're going to do for the rest of your life at 18.
Yep.
And we know that's a flawed way of doing it because they don't know.
Yeah, it's true. I think in this chapter, he shares a couple of like practical applications to play this habit out a little bit.
Okay.
And one that's just really simple. And I was actually looking back at my notes from 2015 on this.
Mm.
And he uses the two questions rule.
Yeah.
Right. Where he pretty much says, ask yourself these two questions, where it's like, if I made this one change in my personal life, what would it result in? Mm. Right. And then pretty much the same question. If I did that one thing in my professional life, what would it result in? And I think that's just like more of a reframe, right? Like it's not really thinking about, well, what's the end goal here? What's the end game?
Yep.
What am I going to be in 5 or 10 years? Mm. It's nearly just like thinking about it a little bit differently.
Right.
In the sense that, you know, what's the outcome versus just actually taking the action or doing it? So to me, it feels like it's an expansion of being proactive. If now you've got the intention of, I'm going to now make, you know, decisions, or I'm going to control and have more control over my decisions. Like, I think the other part that we sort of skipped over was like the circle of influence, right? Because really the core of that lesson is about that. It's like control the things where you can actually have a level of influence and try to reduce the stuff and the bandwidth that you're giving to things where you actually can't really change the outcome too much.
Right. It's a stoic mentality.
It's a bit like that, right? Like where it's like, focus on what you can control. Yeah. And then that then feeds into now when you have that, it's like, now start thinking about things a little bit differently in terms of the end goal or the reason why. Like to me, this is more a why question, right? You know, with the end in mind, it's like, well, why are we doing this? How's this linked to my purpose or whatever it is that I'm about or my values? And I love those two questions because I had a note in my phone from 2015.
I love that this theme is you've got all these
there's a few notes here. Notes.
Yeah, yeah, I only started really journaling in the last three, 4 years. I don't have anything. Well, when I was younger.
Yeah, well, you read these books when you were like 15 years old.
Yeah, but I didn't write anything while I read them.
I was actually trying to like figure stuff out when I was
reading. Yeah, that's beautiful.
But one of my things that I had on a personal level, and this was from 2015, 2016, is I could already see at that point that like if drinking, right? Like if I just stopped drinking, I knew it even back then that it was going to have such a big impact on my life on a personal level.
Yeah, me too.
Right. And I didn't stop drinking until then 2 years after that.
Mm.
And that, like, just looking back on that note from 2016, like, it took a couple of years to get to that point.
Yeah.
So it's been, like, since 2018 now. And I was actually reflecting with another friend the other day. I'm like, as much as that was a really, like, you know, kind of difficult decision to make, because there's so much fun associated with it too, and the social interactions and all the other bits and pieces that come along with that decision. I'm like, now when I look back over the last 5 years, I probably haven't made a better decision that's compounded favorably for me than that.
Wow.
Like, over the last 5 years, where that decision just pays dividends every single day. Don't lose time, clarity of thinking, limiting making bad decisions, you know, being better with the kids and the family, like, being a better leader, like, reducing the chances of getting cancelled, like, all of these things that it does. That
I don't think it reduces our chances of getting cancelled.
Ours are still pretty high.
Pretty high.
Just even little things, right? Like, having to make a decision. It's like, oh, do I have one or two tonight?
Yeah.
Or not? Do I leave my car? Do I drive? Like, just all of these things. So I think back to that and I'm like, what a cool question that that asked me and probably planted the idea even 2 years before I made that decision. And I think that's where it's pretty powerful in terms of thinking of the end in mind, right?
Yeah.
Because then it was like, all right, now
what would my life be like?
Am I picturing it? Right? Like, because that's the hardest thing when you're trying to change a habit or something that's really embedded. It's really hard to see what the actual benefits are going to be when you don't have too much evidence of that. And you're actually one of the big examples, because I think you stopped drinking like, what, 8-9 years ago? And
more than that.
I remember chatting to you and you were probably the first person that I found that was actually still pretty sociable, could tell good stories, could interact. Like, that was my biggest fear. I'm like, maybe I'll never speak again.
Never going to tell anyone that I love them again.
After 8 p.m., I'm going to be a mute. Like, that's it. Like, especially on a Friday or Saturday night, that's done. And and I think you nearly have to see the examples of that. And now, obviously, 5 years later, like, it's becoming a pretty common thing now.
Yeah.
I think yeah, I think that's one of just the examples of sort of thinking with the end in mind and how to embed that habit off. Yeah, is there any decisions or behaviors or attitudes? It could be any of those things where if you adjust them a little bit, what level of impact can that have on your life?
Yeah, and I guess the only reason why I brought up the other side of it is just because I've seen so many people stop themselves from trying something because they overcomplicate the process of clarity. Because to me, this is a great habit for gaining clarity. But then I find that people obsess over the clarity and then they don't realize that clarity also comes from taking action.
For sure.
You know, even if you, and I don't know, right? I'm just going to call this one out, right? I don't know that if at the time when you were thinking about quitting drinking, did you have that full blown clarity that it was going to completely make your life better? Because even when I stopped drinking, Ali, it was super difficult because every time I went out, why are you not drinking?
Yeah.
Dude, you think you're better than us? Is that what it is? You think you're better than us? I was like, no, man, I just don't want to drink. I don't think I'm better than you. I just don't want to drink.
Yeah.
Because again, I just think it's hard. I don't think all of us are able to have that clarity.
Oh, for sure.
You know, super hard. Especially when we're younger. Again, I'm just calling back out. I'm just big shout out for those who listen to us who are a lot younger in that. Look, it's great if you can get the clarity. And even if you can't, it's all right.
Yeah.
Just take more action. Yeah.
And then moves, right? Like, we were talking about health before.
Yeah.
Like, we're still figuring that one out.
Yeah, I know.
Right? Yeah. Like, it's all like, we're going to the gym every single day.
Yeah, no, I don't want to do that.
We just ate as much fried chicken as we could have before.
We left two pieces on the plate when we left. True. I felt really
sad.
That
was responsible.
That was sad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's cool to see. I think you're right, though. I definitely do agree with you. And it's one of the things that I know you've shared a few times in the podcast. It's that if you are struggling with clarity and the reasons of, you know, why I should do something, figure it out by taking the actions, actually learn on the fly.
Yeah.
And that will help you iterate. And I 100% agree with that. Like,
it's both. Yeah, they're both. Absolutely. Angles. You know, if you can sit down and you've got a good operating system and you can see the end.
Yeah.
Right. And then you've got that clarity. Great. Fantastic. But then there's also a massive group of people who won't be able to do that.
Sure.
Right. Whether the operating system's not there or the situation's so difficult that it's just not clear. Then it's about just look for the best move you can and just do it.
Absolutely.
Don't overthink it.
100%.
You don't have to have the end in mind. If you got it, great. If you don't, keep moving forward.
Yeah.
The key here is progress, not perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I agree.
Because the only way to get, you'll never get to perfection, but the only way to get as close as you can to perfection is through progress. That's the only way. The only path that leads to that is sustainable progress.
Yep. There's an interesting exercise in that chapter where it talks about the funeral exercise.
Right.
Did you ever think about that? Like, is there anything when you now reflect on this? So essentially just high level with the exercise. It's like, how would you imagine? I think it's a family member, a really good friend. It was a colleague. And it was somebody from within your community.
Instagram follower.
Yeah, that's right. Instagram follower. How do you imagine all four of those people doing
the
a speech?
The closer you get to me, the more of a loser I am. And the further you get away from me, the more amazing I am. Simple. Simple. Just straight up.
Don't get straight too up. Close.
Don't get pay when to talk at my funeral.
It's like, we want the five newest Instagram followers.
Yeah. The ones that just watch my viral videos, we want them to come speak at my funeral.
They're going to have the most favorable things. Yeah.
That was a really good exercise.
Yeah, I love the idea of breaking that down in the four too.
I know.
So cool.
Well, because that's what I immediately thought about. I thought about it's the people closest to you and then slowly further away. Yeah. So I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Did you have any insights there? Like that. When you thought about it, it made you go, I should change the way I'm living, or there's something I should be doing more of.
I think it's one that really stuck out that when I read it maybe 8 years ago or 9 years ago or whenever it was, I think I started subconsciously using this as a frame to make a lot of decisions and moves as well.
Based on how,
just thinking about it back then because-
Give me an example. Like, do you have something where you-
Yeah, I'll find the notes. So
while you're finding the note, there's this really great quote where Stephen Covey says, "It's incredibly easy to get caught up in an activity trap in the busyness of life, to work harder and harder at climbing the ladder of success, only to discover that it's leaning against the wrong wall." Isn't that great?
Yeah, brilliant.
And that was the sentence that made me go, oh, okay, that's why the end in mind is important, right? And then I went back to it. And I just went, but you know what? Sometimes it's inevitable. It's going to be leaning against the wrong wall.
Yeah.
So, all right, climb back down, take it off. And now you have the good operating system that you've developed as a result of leaning on the wrong wall to go put it on the right wall. Yeah. You can't just immediately in life put it on the right wall. That rarely ever bloody happens.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a really cool thing, right? Because after you get the wrong wall multiple times, that's what you said, learning by doing.
Yeah.
Is that sooner or later, you're just going to, your chances of putting it on the right
wall. Well, that's why now you need to play chess. You need to play chess.
That's right.
And if you keep putting it on the wrong wall and you can't do anything about it, that's when you need external intelligence.
That's true.
You need to bring in mentors. You need to bring in consultants, whatever you can, to go, where's the right wall? What the hell is going on, right?
There's so many why questions in this too. I think the better we get at asking the right questions to ourselves and answering those questions, or asking the right questions to others that can help us. That's what helps this, right? Because that's the thing where I think so many of us, you know, when you talked about the operating system, just as I was thinking about that a little bit more, it's because we've got too many fears, or we don't want to hear the truth, where we don't actually go and ask people these questions, and we probably don't really want to ask ourselves these questions either.
Mm.
Right? So it's really embracing it. Like, when you think about that operating system with this around self-awareness, it's getting super honest with yourself or vulnerable to the point where you can actually get that advice. Otherwise, the reality is you will keep putting the ladder up against that same wall, because that's just habit, right? Well,
you know, it's what's sad? Pattern. It's already on the wrong wall. You know it's on the wrong wall. You're still climbing up.
Yeah. Like, hey, we need longer ladder. Yeah.
I know, but you know you're doing it.
Yeah.
That's rough.
Yeah. And I think that happens to
that's rough.
All of us at some point in our time.
For sure.
Right?
Mm. That was me at university. Every year that went by, I knew I was in the wrong damn degree. Mm. I knew I wasn't even meant to be there, but I just kept going.
Yeah.
And I think there was nothing that was more demoralizing than knowing you're on the wrong wall, but still climbing up the rungs of that ladder.
Yeah.
Cue sad music. That was,
But then,
wow, that's freaky deaky to think about.
And sometimes it flips as well, right? Like, you hear about it a lot with, like, the example that sticks out to me is Andre Agassi, the tennis player. His autobiography is amazing.
I still haven't read it.
And it's all about, like, essentially his father, like, forcing him to be a tennis player, right? So he has this example where, like, he just sees he could just picture like his defining memory of his dad's hand is his arm just dropping a tennis ball and then him having to hit it over his shoulder, like not even seeing his face. And that caused him so much grief. But then at the end of it all, he's like, well, I hated that for such a big part, right? Because essentially for him, most of his life felt like that ladder was up against the wrong wall.
Mm.
And then he became one of the best in the world at it. And then he won all the tournaments. And then he got to create this life, right, from tennis. And he's like, and I think pretty much at some point it switched, right?
Funny.
Yeah, because he's like, he nearly got so high up that ladder where he's like, oh, well, I'm already here now. What can I turn this into, right? Maybe it wasn't my choice and I didn't really want to be there. But it's like he kind of put the silver lining on it. And he's like, yeah, brilliant. So it's like you could have finished that accounting degree.
Don't say that.
And then just become the best CFO that's ever existed.
Don't say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mum doesn't listen to this episode. But yeah. Don't say that. She's like, oh, no, you couldn't have been an accountant on the world.
You should have just been a pharmacist. Yeah. Well, like you were meant to be.
That's interesting that after a certain point, even after a certain point on the ladder, you never know.
You never know. You might get higher.
But then again, you see what I mean? Start with the end in mind.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, yeah, I get it. But I just think life is just so complex. Yeah. And it's so windy you cannot see beyond the corner, man. You know, I get it. I'm not acknowledging how wonderful this lesson is, but it's just, I guess I'm looking at it so pragmatically that it's,
And I think that's the thing probably with all of these seven habits. They're really principle based.
That's right.
You've kind of nearly got to put your own.
The dinosaurs aren't real in Jurassic Park kind of thing, right? It's just, you know, go along with it. It's cool. I get it. Yeah. No, I know.
But it's good to question it, though. I like it.
Well, that's what I've been trying to do, Ali, in that these books that we're reading as well, I'm trying to hold two opinions in my head at the same time. Mm. I'm really trying.
For sure.
Like, I don't want to just read books and then and just agree with all of it. Hey, this is great. This person wrote it. They must have studied it. I'm just trying to play with two ideas in my head.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Because I think that's it's just an important thing to be able to do.
Mm. Well, that's how we unlock new insights as well, I think.
Mm.
On this. Yeah, that's cool.
One part of the book that I thought was really interesting in this particular chapter here, beginning with the end in mind, is understanding how you are centered. Mm. And I love how they said, you know, are you spouse-centered, family-centered? Mm. I'm going to read them all. There's a big list. Yeah. So are you spouse-centered, family-centered, money-centered, work-centered, possession-centered, pleasure-centered, friend-centered, enemy-centered, church-centered, or self-centered?
Mm.
And depending on where you are centered, it's just giving you a bit of a reality check. For example, if you're spouse-centered, your feelings of security are based on the way your spouse treats you. Your direction comes from your own needs, wants, and those of your spouse. So it gives you a sense of, well, your end in mind, where does it kind of lie? Mm. Is it centered around your spouse, your family, your money, your work, your et cetera? Yeah. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Just to have a bit of a self-awareness activity. Where do you think you're centered? I'll say it again. Is it spouse, family, money, work, possession, pleasure, friend, enemy, church, or self?
Yeah. I think at different times of my life, it's you're changed. Different.
Interesting. Where are you now?
Varies. I'd say it's probably more value-centered.
Yeah.
Like, definitely, rather than... And then I play in each of those
value-centered?
Realms. Yeah.
Interesting.
And then, like, play in those realms. But I'd say I probably, if I'm going to lean to one at the moment, it would be, like, pleasure-centered.
Mm,
In terms of, like, travel, hobbies, whatever it is. Like, they're the things that can...
And I'm self-centered, aren't I?
You've only checked, like, your Instagram following, like, four times in the last 10 minutes, so that's fine.
No, I did not. Watch the video back. I did not. That was a false accusation, man. That was false. I checked it four times before we started, but not during.
Oh, man. Like, I love it. That's hilarious.
I think out of these, I don't think I'm self-centered. I think out of these... That's what a self-centered person will say.
Super self-aware.
I think I'm a combination of these right now. I think I'm getting a lot better at family-centered. I'm still money-centered and work-centered.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think I play within those three. And I want to get better at, you know, pleasure-centered, you know. Yeah. I want to get better at that.
And I love how that chapter finishes.
Yeah.
Because then it says, like, the ideal is to be principle-centered,
mm.
right? So then you're combining and you're aligned more with your values.
Yeah.
And then these are just like sort of wheels that, you know, are off on the outside. These are the external ways that that manifests. And then you can just sort of play in those as you need to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But yeah, and I think that's the end point of that chapter. It's like, you don't actually want to be fundamentally driven by just one of these things because it's too surface level.
And you're all of it.
That's right.
We're so messy. And I love what you said right at the start of this little conversation here about these different places where you can be centered, is you talked about at different points in life, we're in a different place.
That's right.
And I know we joked around a bit about being self-centered, but you know what? There's a time and place for that where you need to think about yourself.
For sure.
And if you don't, if you never play in the self-centered area and you never kind of focus on yourself, that's also dangerous.
Well, I think to have a really well-rounded life experience, you probably have to dabble in all of those.
In all of those, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's interesting.
They're all pretty big part of the life experience, but you probably just don't want that to really dictate you. I think that's where we see people where they get really angry when somebody has an opposing view or belief.
Mm.
It's like, no. Well, I believe in money. And now you're saying that you don't believe in money. It's like, we can't be friends. I think if you attach too heavily to any one of those, it's probably more likely to cause problems than benefits.
As we kind of round out that one, I just got a thought where it's like, start with the end in mind and hold that loosely.
Yeah.
Right. Because I think it's important.
It's adapt. Yeah.
Yeah. Just adapt and don't look at it as rigid, not too rigid.
For sure.
It's so difficult, right? Because sometimes you have to be rigid with it, because the more rigid you are, sometimes the harder you try. You're like, no, I have to hit this. And then sometimes if you're too rigid, you demoralize yourself. So again, it's so much of this comes back to self-awareness.
Yeah.
What do you need? Do you need a rigid goal? Do you have to be held to that? Or do you need a bit more flexibility? Yeah. You got to work out what floats your boat.
Absolutely. Mm. I like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's loop back to the funeral exercise.
All right. Back to the funeral.
So the ones that I had back then was from Chantel it was a great father, a provider, best friend, love of my life.
Mm,
right?
That's beautiful.
With friends, funnily enough, and this is how it's changed, right? Because this is from 2015. Mm. I was like, he's the life of the party. Right. So that probably, I'd say that does not exist now at all.
That's why I laughed. Yeah. I was like, I'll leave the life of the party. Yeah.
There was a time.
There was a time before me, bro.
But ones that are still out there is like, generous, smart, wise, and somebody that, you know, admired or looked up to.
Oh,
right. Okay. So that's sort of in there.
For sure. You're living that out.
As a colleague, you know, a leader or mentor, an innovator, somebody that helped me achieve my potential.
Mm.
And then I'd like community, and that was largely around the golf stuff. But yeah, just sort of selfless in the passion to create something special.
Hey, that's beautiful.
Mm.
Yeah, you're doing it, man.
So it's cool, like looking back on these, right? But the reason why I think it's cool to share these things is have these as little time capsules at different points in your life, like every 5 years or 10 years, where you can look back and be like, hey, did I end up sort of progressing towards that ideal?
Yeah. Or right. If I died during that period, would they have said those things?
Yeah, would it have somewhat aligned there or not, right? Now, the reality could be very different, but then I think it's another self-awareness tool.
Yeah.
If we think about this chapter more being around that,
where
you can use these future signposts to then try to guide you along the way as well.
And it's probably a great thing to do once every 2 years, one year even, because goalposts move every year.
Absolutely.
The movie, because you change every year.
Yeah. Like even in that example, right? Like I have a couple there that are just completely irrelevant now.
Yeah. How funny is that?
Yeah.
That's interesting. How long ago was that?
That was 2015.
Wow. So you wanted to be life of the party 2015.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Mm.
Wow.
Well, I think it goes back to the roles that we play, right? Because back then that was, I don't know if it was an appointed role or not, but it was just how I would have defined myself.
I love that. I haven't done that. I like it. I like it. But I like the, like you said, the different roles.
Yeah.
How different people see you and how you live in different areas of your life. How are you as a contributor to your family? How are you as a contributor to your friends? How are you as a contributor to society? Yeah. I love that because it defines it in different buckets, you know, and it allows you to think of goals in the different areas of your life that you may not often think about.
Sure.
That's cool. That's powerful. Number three.
Number three.
All right. Put first things first.
Mm.
You can start this one.
You've been starting them all.
I know. I'm trying to hand over the mic, mate. Yeah. I'm trying not to be a hog.
I just shared the last example. You just checked on your Jeez. This is really, the keynote speaker is really putting me in the spotlight.
Why are you buying time?
Yeah.
Have you not read the third one? What's going on?
I'm like, I've not even read this book. I'm literally just, as you name the habits, I'm just slowly trying to piecemeal something together.
You're just Googling things on your phone. Oh, gosh.
All righty. First things first.
Yeah. And you're like, so you just got to put first things first.
This is one of my favorite things.
All right.
So, in this, he talks about the quadrant.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So it's like the four quadrants around time management is what I think it's called.
Here. Yeah. Right?
Mm-hmm. And
yeah, talk us through.
This is really cool, right? So it pretty much talks about things that are either important or urgent, right? And then what's the other axis there?
It's got important, not important, urgent, not urgent.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we're looking at importance and urgency, and it's drawn up. Maybe we'll edit in the actual graph.
I think you just got to describe it.
if somebody Googles this.
There's nobody here, Ali. It's just me and you.
You just made up
this imaginary person that's going to do the work for us. Yeah, this is hilarious. We're a massive production of 20 people here, Ali. Yeah.
Should be live.
Yeah.
should happen right now.
It's like, can someone just edit in something smarter here?
Four boxes.
Yeah.
Box one is essentially not. He's got it on his laptop.
Yeah, I've got it on my laptop here. Cool.
Look. So the first box is not important and urgent, right? Mm-hmm. The second box is not urgent and important.
Okay. So I think you're going to describe a box and give us an example.
Okay.
Describe a box, give us an example.
I love this.
No, just an example of a situation that is not important and not urgent.
Cool.
Yeah, right.
So an important and urgent one would be like a crisis.
Yeah.
Right? Something really like an emergency.
A fire happened.
Fire's happened.
Yeah.
Got to address it.
Yep.
Important and not urgent is relationship building. Mm. It's planning. It's strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Urgent and not important is interruptions. Emails, those things coming through. It's
DMs.
And not important, not urgent is just things that are like, personal pleasure, trivial.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, do you have time for a coffee? I've got a new business idea. Yeah. Multi-level marketing campaign, right?
Yeah. It's a nutritional supplement. Yeah. With aromatherapy in it. But
hey, one of my uncles really believes in that stuff, right?
And it's really cool that...
I'm just having a bit of your water, by the way.
No, go for it. Yeah. And I think what the author really speaks about is how important it is to plan quadrant two, which is in the, it's not urgent, but it's highly important.
Yeah. The relationship building stuff.
Right. And there's some really great graphs there around, that's where you get the most sort of long-term return, the most values created. And if you can focus in on those tasks.
Yeah.
And I actually remember this being taught to me, like maybe it was even at uni or earlier than that. Mm-hmm. Somebody used that graph. Mm-hmm. Just really stood out. That it's like if you want to maximize your value, that's highly effective people, I think generally play in that second quadrant for a lot of the time, 60 to 80% of the time.
Well, quadrant two is where you want to focus your time.
Yeah.
But I will say this. I think a great activity for you to do if you feel you're not very good at prioritization and you feel that I'm so busy all of the time, but I'm not making progress in my life or my business, then you need to take all the tasks that you do within a 1 month period or 1 week period, document every task you do, and then put them into each quadrant.
Oh, that's good.
And then work out exactly where am I spending most of my time? And I think the majority of the times, if you're not getting a lot of progress, you're finding yourself spending time in quadrant one, three, and four.
Yep.
Whereas you should be spending a lot of time in quadrant two, which again is planning, recognizing new opportunities, and building relationships. Yeah. These are just three power moves. They're the ones that they move the needle.
Mm-hmm.
They fully move the needle.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think really good checkpoints too is if you're like, I'm too busy. I'm too overwhelmed. I don't have the time.
Yeah.
I can't do that. Probably not living in quadrant two enough. And it's like, how can you make some slight adjustments to spend a little bit more time there?
I'll share with you a pain that I have. And the pain that I have is in quadrant four.
Mm.
Whereas when I first had 10,000 followers online, anytime anyone sent me a DM, would get a voice reply.
Yeah.
Right. And when you're at 10,000 followers, you might get one a week.
Yeah.
Manageable. Now on all our platforms, there's over 3 million people. I've had to do away with pleasantries.
Yeah.
I can't. There is no way now.
Mm.
And at the start of the social media craze for me, I was trying to get back to dude everyone.
Yeah. Well,
and I was doing all quadrant four activities. And I was doing that maybe for like a good week, and I've just felt exhausted.
Yeah.
And it's like the equivalent of, yeah, you're just pedaling the fastest you've ever pedaled your whole life, but you're not moving.
Mm.
And that's what quadrant four made me think of when I was going through it again. I went, wow, that whole week I was purely playing in quadrant four.
Mm.
And it was just freaking geeky. It was just, yeah, so much movement, but not moving nowhere.
When you look at that grid,
yeah,
how would you split up like where you spend your time?
I don't have that many quadrant one things.
Yeah.
Not that many. I'd say that takes up quadrant one, maybe takes up 20% of my time.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I've got deliverables and I've got issues that could arise. I would spend 20% of my time in quadrant one. And then I would say 40% in quadrant two.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe, scary to think about, but I think maybe 20% quadrant three, 20% quadrant four.
Mm-hmm.
So most of my time is in quadrant two.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, that's the split. It's not like all of it.
Yep.
What about you?
Yeah, I think I try to spend a fair bit of time in quadrant two.
Yeah, you're
just
two.
Because I have
you're
to.
You're mostly like, in two because you're the CEO.
Yeah, it's a bit, hard. Probably need to spend a bit more time in some of the other quadrants, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's nearly the other way.
Mm.
You know, especially with some of the more urgent stuff, that's where I can fall behind, where like something is actually urgent, but I've put it in the not important basket and then I'm a bottleneck, right? Mm. So something that needs to be progressed because I'm still living in quadrant two doesn't then happen.
Right.
So that's probably my one. I like spending time in quadrant four too. I think it's pretty fun. Like where, that's like just a treat where it's, you just sort of play around.
It's almost a form of meditation.
Yeah, it's pretty much meditating.
Yeah, it's like
quadrant four is meditating.
Yeah,
meditating.
Yeah. Ish. Yeah, yeah, meditating.
But then you can also say meditating's in quadrant two, right? If it nourishes you and makes you healthier too.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah. It's different forms of it.
Yeah.
I love this. I love this quote from Stephen where he says, "The key is not to prioritize what's on your schedule, but to schedule your priorities."
Yeah.
He's so good. He's so good with his like one-liners.
Where he just says the same thing, but reverses the order.
Yeah, it's brilliant. But it's great, isn't it? The key is not to prioritize what's on your schedule, but to schedule your priorities. Mm. And I love this one because it just makes you sit and think at different stages of your life, your priorities change. And here's the dilemma that I see is that people don't acknowledge those priority changes at different periods of their life. So they do the same things through all periods. And then they wonder why at different periods they're really unhappy and they don't feel good. Well, it's because your priorities shifted 12 months ago. They changed orders, but you're still following the same schedule.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? So you've got to adjust the way you spend your time based on the way your priorities have changed and acknowledge that on a yearly basis, our priorities change.
Mm.
You know, and I think, we just have to acknowledge that and then adjust for it. Because if you're not, if someone asks you what's your list of priorities and you don't know, again, that lack of clarity, I think is really, really dangerous for
sure.
Yeah.
And I think we've seen personally just the power of scheduling.
Yeah.
And how much it's impacted our lives. Like, I remember when I first started using Google Calendar.
Mm.
And if I really did it properly, sometimes there'd be three things scheduled in for the exact same time. And then you quickly got to realize it's like, well, I can't physically be at those three places. Like, and it just automatically, like the power of Google Calendar and having a pretty clean and updated, whether it's Google Calendar or Outlook, whatever you're using.
Yeah, iCal.
It's just then seeing that and being like, look, the reality is for that hour or two, I really can only do one thing at a time.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that was a big realization that I got as well after a period of religiously scheduling stuff.
Mm.
It's like, and every single day, actually, we'll only get three or four things of any decent impact finished.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I don't have to try to jam in 40 different things on the to-do list. Because I remember you'd have these to-do lists and you just feel like a failure. And it's like, I only got through 11 out of the 45.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, you were never going to get through the 45. You know, like that's a month.
Yeah.
Or that's 3 weeks worth.
Mm.
And I found that just even with using Asana as a project managing tool, because you can go back and you can run reports. It's pretty consistent. Even in highly productive months, you end up with like 100 completed actions or projects or whatever progressed. And that's 3 a day on average.
Well, you know what that's really cool with that is it recalibrates your expectation.
For sure it does.
Because normally our level of expectation of what we're able to do is just way out of whack. And when you learn how to prioritize and you have a system, then you can look at it and you go, okay, well, this is a 6-month thing that I'm doing. Yeah. Otherwise, our emotions come into play and we go, oh, yeah, I want this in 6 hours. I want this in 6 weeks. Goes, no, no, no. That list of things that you're about to do, you aren't even launching that course till July. So it gives you a more realistic timeline. So prioritization, what it actually does is it gives us a clear indication of what the roadmap looks like.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Absolutely.
I didn't think about it from that point of view. That's cool.
You can see it coming out. And then I think it also helps with the expectations of others. Because once you start realizing, hey, well, if I can only get these many things done, how can I then expect somebody else to get 55 things done for me as well? And I think that it helps with measuring that. But that's one of the biggest exercises. Like even when I've done advisory and consulting for people that are like, just got so much going on. I'm juggling so many balls, you know, all these things are happening. I don't feel like I'm progressing. Pretty common thread is exactly what you said before. It's do a log of your time and actually see where you're allocating that time. And I haven't found a single case yet where like just so much of the effort was based on reactive stuff. Whereas if more time was spent in the proactive or planning. In quadrant two, it would actually solve 80-90% of all that reactive stuff. It's like, oh, well, you're still doing, like you mentioned this and you've been doing it for a month now. That's just packaging that up into a role that you need to hire for or whatever it is, or delegating it.
Saying no. I think no is the remedy to no longer doing too much of the quadrant one, three, and four. You just gotta have to start saying no.
It's finding domino moves too. Tim Ferriss talks about this. Like, what's the one move I can make that makes all of the other moves irrelevant? And then you find that, and it usually does just knock out a few of those things.
That's a good one. I think this one is a great rule for prioritization. You know, if you feel like life is a little bit chaotic, you feel like you're pedaling nonstop and you're not getting anywhere, apply this one. Apply rule three.
A few other great books I think on this is like there's a book called The One Thing.
Essentialism.
The 80-20 rule.
Yeah, check out our podcast episode on essentialism. Yeah, we did one on that already. Awesome. That was a great book.
I think that's probably credit to this book as well, because it's, what, 30, 40 years old, I think.
Yeah, I know.
And I think you mentioned this earlier and you said it's like, well, there's actually been books written just focusing on one of these topics, and it really does sort of stand the test of time as a bit of a grandfather book.
Number four. Think win-win. I mean, you're the negotiation master in this friendship, and I think you've really learnt the art of win-win. You know, we were talking at lunch, and you were saying there's not many relationships or engagements that you enter where it's not win-win. You've lived by this, whereas me is different. When I was young, I did not operate from an abundant mindset. I think to get to win-win requires an abundant mindset. Right? I had full scarcity mindset when I was young. It wasn't, to me, it was not win-win. When I was young, it was win-lose, mate.
When you grow up like how we did, it's
when you don't have a lot, man, it's
because
win-lose.
We're used to seeing it. That's how life plays out. It's like usually you're losing, first of all, most of the time. And when you do win, there has to be a loser. Like, that's right. It just doesn't really work where everyone wins.
Sorry, I saw the funniest thing. I saw the funniest video, right? This video was a coach on a soccer field. And he says to the kids, he goes to the bunch of little kids, he goes, when you get out there on the field, it's all about winning, all right? You either win or you lose. And your dads and your moms who say that it's all about having fun, your dad's a loser. I was like, damn it, that's hilarious. I was like, that's so funny. But that's literally how I thought when I was young. I didn't understand that there was such thing as a win-win. I mean, if you'd explain win-win to me as a teenager, I would have been like, Nah, this is a scam. You can't both win. How do you both win chess? Right? So many games in life that we're exposed to at a young age. It's all win-lose.
Well, I always thought it was just a joke. Like, it was just something that people would write and, like, negotiate books to make them feel, seems feel like that they were, like, real, like, I'd heard of the concept earlier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like,
and
concept.
I'm like, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Win-win.
I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go to Harvey Norman and negotiate a win-win outcome deal. On the TV. It's like
I give you nothing, you give me TV, win-win. Yeah.
Like, oh, my God, how amazing does this sound?
Yeah, it sounds great.
And then, yeah, it wasn't until, like, I was lucky when I worked at uni, I got to do a course at Harvard on negotiation.
I still think it's so cool that you went all the way to Harvard to do this course.
It was cool. It was such an amazing experience, man. And super grateful that I got to do it. But that's where really early on, they kind of ease you into a really transactional type of negotiation.
Mm.
And I went super aggressive, right? Because I'm like, I'm going to dominate this class. I definitely shouldn't be here. Everyone else here is so successful. So I'm like, I want to get the best price on this negotiation and just stamp the flag of the best negotiator that they've ever seen.
Yeah.
And like, did like, went really straight level on this because I think the other person was just like, all right, fine. Like, let's just do it so we can finish up the negotiation. And I like, got a ridiculous price on the thing, walking in all happy. And then they're like, so who got the prices, right? And then it's like, stand up. So it was like, sit down. And
so who got more than 1,000? Who got more than 1,500? You were the last one to sit down.
Yeah. So I was like, sitting there, I'm like, 120,000. Wow. It's like everyone averaged sort of around 60 or 70. And they're like, Sally, you really think you won, right? Like, everyone give him a round of applause. And it's like, well, you were the actual loser of this exercise.
Wow.
And I'm like, oh, no. I'm like, what a lesson am I about to be taught right now?
Wow.
And they're like, and then they showed you how the actual negotiation played out. Mm. And it was just that, yeah, pretty much the other side was that because of that deal, that person will never, ever want to negotiate.
And work with you ever again.
And they were planning on actually giving you like another $1 million worth of deals. If you'd settled more at like a 60 to 80 grand. So
they would have referred you to other clients.
And even given you more stuff. And then it was like, and these were real negotiations that have taken place where they've done like interviews with the people and everyone outside of it.
Yeah.
So then it just sort of opened my eyes to, all right, sometimes winning the transactional part of a negotiation is actually losing. And then I think the evolution of that has also been now, like I'll be sitting there and we get similar things like to yourself where it's like a good deal gets presented.
Yeah.
And I'm like, if this holistically isn't great and I can't picture us doing stuff in 5 years or 10 years time,
right?
Probably not really worth anyone's time because you saying yes to a deal that isn't optimal or might turn into a win-loss, the actual trade-off is that you're losing space for a win-win arrangement as well. So I think it does actually hold up, like win-win.
Yeah.
As much as I'd love to say it's just hoo-ha and it doesn't really work. Like sometimes you do have to be transactional.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like if you're haggling at a market or something like that, awesome, right? But usually transactional negotiations like that or interactions, they're very short-term.
They're once off.
Yeah.
They're once off.
And even then, like I now think about it at a market. Yeah. It's like, was there any point even haggling on this? Like I could just make the whole experience more of a win-win.
Mm.
Give the person what they want. Walk away happy if you can.
Yeah.
And then at least you get that nice feeling of, hey, there was no actual conflict unnecessarily caused as part of this game. So,
well, that's interesting because you think about the marathon as opposed to just thinking about this one sprint.
That's right.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And those win-losses, what I found as well, I have a belief that there's karma to them, right? Like if you engage in too many win-loss types of experiences, even if you win all the time, that follows you.
Yeah.
At some point, you're going to be like, you know what? I remember dealing with that guy 5 years ago.
Mm.
Never do it again.
Yeah.
And then you lose out on opportunities, right? Yeah, so I think there's definitely that element there where even if you think that you're winning, in those win-loss ones, you're probably actually losing anyway, like over a longer period of time.
Such an interesting topic because, it's so interesting that you can do win-win and win.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I think a lot of the times, and again, I go back to scarcity mindset versus abundant mindset. The only way you can play win-win is if you can get yourself into an abundant mindset.
Yeah.
So if you want to do win-win, which ultimately is good for business, right, which is what we're saying here, then you need to have an abundant mindset. I don't think you can do win-win from a scarcity mindset. I don't think it's possible.
No.
You can't, right? There's no way. I mean, you know, you're probably faking it and then you're still probably trying to screw the other person somehow.
Yeah, it's hard.
It's like, hard. I think because, how can you do it from a scarce
you've got
mindset?
Fear, right, that it's going to bite you. I think the way that you can offset it though, and this is what I probably use a lot as well,
yeah,
is where I've got a degree of uncertainty,
yeah,
I'll try to make it a no-brainer. right? So it might not necessarily be a direct win-win at the start.
Yep.
But it'll be like, how do we reduce everyone's risk here as much as possible so we can get started? And that's another, I think, powerful form.
Yeah, I've seen you use that.
So it's not really like fully go all in on the win-win and be like, hey, you know, this is going to be a 10-year partnership or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But if we're a bit uncertain and it's going to be short-term, let's just make it so that, you know, it's everyone's risks are mitigated as much as possible. So it's like a diluted version of win-win rather than the other option, which is no deal.
Mm.
It at least gives it a chance.
Yeah.
And some of these have been the best outcomes of my life. They've actually turned into the greatest win-wins that I've ever had. Because what it allows when you actually go in with like that diluted version of a win-win, it allows everyone to bring their generosity to the table.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you have the foundations of that in a relationship, and if that keeps multiplying, you end up with like a relationship like we have, right?
Mm.
Where it's like starts off very low risk. We always have that rule as well. Like it's always a no-brainer and all of that.
Yeah.
But then over a 5-10 year period, you just build up so much goodwill in the interactions now that it's beyond anything that can ever be transactional at any point. You know, the transactions are just a practical matter if there are any.
Yeah.
It's not really about anything. It's never going to be anything that sleeps lost over or anything like that. And I think that's the ultimate, right, in any exchange of value.
Marvel, it's win-win, but also lower the friction.
Yeah, if you
can. Lower the risk.
If you want to get started, just make it a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Right? That's the other way that you win.
Well, again, it's action. As long as you like, lower that bar of expectation, go in, try something first.
Yeah.
Lower that risk.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I've done that as well. I've gone too big on the win-win. I've just overcomplicated a deal and it's got so many elements in it.
Yeah.
Someone's like,
yeah, it's a bit weird.
No, I'm like, I'm out. Because you've tried to think about every single thing.
Right. It's
like, we'll give everything here. But then they're like, yeah, we just want to actually test this out for a little bit. Yeah. Don't want to do a 10-year partnership. It's like, okay.
But let's say that. Yeah. Let's say you're someone who is still in the mindset of thinking win-lose.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only way to get out of that is to develop an abundant mindset, even before you're abundant.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned this lesson from my dad. I remember my dad is probably one of the most generous people I know.
Yeah.
And I think I've gotten my generosity value from my dad. And my dad, he would always used to say this when we were young. Because when we were young, during Chinese New Year, we'd get those little red packets. And then every year, when we get all our red packet money, I was be sitting there feeling all rich and stuff. My uncles would give, you know, $20 a red packet. It was a lot of money. And he would always encourage me to give some of that money away. I'm like, no, dad, I've only got $200. I can't give this away. Because I just wanted to hoard all the money. And he goes, well, you know, you can give $2. You can give $10. And every year he'd make me do it. And I hated it. I hated it. Because I'm like, this is win-lose. Like my cousin, my little cousin's winning. This is not fair. Why doesn't he give me $10 kind of thing, right? Yeah. That's win-win, you know? Like, what the hell? Why is this just win-lose?
Yeah.
But what my dad was teaching me, man, is he was teaching me that if you don't start developing an abundant mindset when you have a little money, then when you get rich, you will keep all of that. You will not help anyone. It's like the act of generosity is like a muscle. It has to be practiced. You have to practice generosity. And you have to practice it when you don't have a lot. And I really don't want to come across preachy or anything. If you don't want to give, it's up to you. It's your life. You live whatever you want. But I'm just within my family and with my kids, it's just, if you've got a dollar, you can give 5 cents. It's all good. You know, because if you don't give that 5 cents, when you've got a million, you ain't giving $5. You ain't even going to give 5 cents then. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's
a quality of virtue, right? And it might not even be financial. It's like, what can you be generous with?
Yeah.
With what you've got.
Like your energy, your time, your resources.
The actions that you take.
That's right.
Listening. Like there's so many different ways that you can be generous. And it's like finding out, all right, well, what's the way that you do that? Again, I think that's how, like if you think about where the deepest levels of satisfactions come from, it still probably comes from when you impact other people.
You help others.
Again, it's one of those cliche things, but that's what I think everyone's striving for now. You know, for some of us, we have to get to a level of, call it internal security before we can think like that.
Yeah.
For others, they're just born like that. You know, like there's certain people that from the day that they were born, they'll just give the shit off their back.
I think that's what they had.
Yeah.
I definitely wasn't born like that.
My mum was like that.
Yeah, right.
And then my dad was like the opposite. He was so win-lose that every single interaction that he had, like unless there was a loser and he was the winner, it would never work. And every relationship he had was short-term, right? Like they're those people that are like drifters nearly that go through because there's just like the trail of damage that's caused because they can't really manage it. So I kind of got to learn from both of them a little bit, whereas my mum went probably the other way. It's like, she's like, if somebody does something nice for you, you do it back three times.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
like you go completely beyond it. Or even if they don't, you start with that.
Yeah.
And it was like finding, I think as a kid, I was like trying to find the balance a little bit of, all right, how do you do a bit of both?
How fortunate are we? You had your mum, I had my dad.
Mm. Yeah.
My dad was all about generosity and win-win. Still is.
It's still probably one of the qualities that I aspire to the most.
Yeah, me too.
But it's still a practicing.
Yeah, for
like,
sure.
I feel like nowhere near the level where I'd want to be on it, but still learning it.
Mm.
I think that is the hard thing when you grow up, like in a very scarce environment. Yeah. Like there's that little bit that's still always there, right? It is. It is always there. It's like, I want to give you everything. Because like to me,
I don't think it's about giving everything.
Well, that's the ultimate, right? Like if you think about, I think about like people that are like devout monks, right? They just denounce everything and give it all away. I'm like, all right, that's like the gold standard of this virtue versus,
just
hoarding
everything. Just be a silver medalist in this realm of, don't be
a gold
medalist.
That's right. Yeah, and you have to be there. Yeah. What medal do you want?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely experienced the benefits of win-win.
Yeah.
When you work with clients, even, you see, I've done it in a different way. Even at times when I feel like I've lost out in a deal, that in that deal, even though it started as they win, I feel like I lost a little bit, I would still in that moment try to give a little more.
Yeah.
And when I do, it always ends up better. Because then the next time we have another opportunity to work together, guess what? They're no longer going to make me lose. And now it's a win-win. So I've just been able to look at this as, even if you are in relationships or business dealings where it's currently win-lose, it's incredible what a little bit of generosity does. If the other person's a good person, right? If the other person is not so generous, then don't work with them anymore. That's a good opportunity to stop, right? Whereas I've done things for clients where I go really above and beyond, man. And then next time, guess what? I've got a bigger deal now. You know, so you can train others who currently play with you as a win-lose to ultimately become a win-win by you just giving a little more.
Yeah.
Even when you feel like you've lost out, you can still use that as a little bit of power to try to win them over. And if it doesn't work, then you back out of that.
I think for most people, there's a fundamental desire to reciprocate.
It's human. It's human, man.
Like we want to do it. When you're in a relationship where like it's all about just giving and positivity and all that, like how energizing is it? And
it's great.
You go above and beyond.
Yeah.
Like what you can. And I think you're definitely one of the examples that I've learned from watching you do that over the years. Mm. And I've seen it like not only just from the fact that I think it's a very core value of yours, but I've actually seen all the benefits, like even from a practical standpoint, that happen from that type of just energy and attitude. And it's one of like, I think, just a very core compounding natural law nearly, if you can execute. Like very rarely. Like I just always tell you, I'm like, and I think Pei Wen's probably been similar with you. It's like, surely at some point, this approach is going to mean that someone's going to take advantage of him pretty seriously. And it's like, well, the reality is
I did get scammed by Gardner.
but like, that's like one,
no, but you know
one
what's
out of like 100,
do you
right?
Do you want an update on that story?
Oh, yeah. What's the update?
So I literally got a call from a sergeant from SAPOL, South Australian Police, and they're going to try to get my money back. Isn't that crazy?
That's hilarious.
And it was also because I did an event for SAPOL for free.
That's hilarious.
I did a training session for free. Yeah. But like you said, I think there is a karma involved in this.
Yeah.
I really do believe there's a karma involved.
You can't win them all, right?
You can't win them all, man. You can't and it's okay. Don't try to win them.
You don't have to.
You don't have to. Yeah. If you just win the majority, it's good.
Yeah.
Like win-win ones. Create more win-win situations. Yeah. It's funny how that both started for us as we're like, no, that's not possible.
Yeah.
And then now it's just such a powerful, principle.
It's now a tool that we use for evil.
Yeah, I love that answer for evil. To be able to take over the world will create win-win situations for everyone.
Just going
to
dominate through win-win situations and false generosity.
Yeah.
That's actually really driven by our own desires and needs.
But then at some point, society doesn't care because it's overall net positive.
Just fully commercialized generosity as a virtue.
But on the inside, you're super evil, but you're just making the world such a good place.
It's like, hey, Vin, I just did like five really nice things and now they're
super
paying us like
win-win deals, bro. But you're like, you're just an absolute wanker.
Oh, shit. I just love how we put like such a horrible tinge on something that was quite nice for a bit.
There's someone out there doing this. There's someone out there doing this, calling their best friend going, you know what, man? I just got a $500,000 deal and they got $500,000 worth of value in their face.
Now, like our families are friends.
Yeah, and our families are friends.
We're going to go on a really nice holiday.
And I really enjoyed it. So joke's on them. That's so stupid.
That's hilarious.
That's so stupid. He's like a stupid evil character. Just
despicable me.
Pretending to be nice. Like, but
ultimately just a really good guy. A
really good guy inside with a long nose. Number five.
Yeah.
Seek first to understand, then be understood. That to me is all about active listening. It is. That's really just about.
I figured this was going to be your one.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, a quote from Stephen, because he's just brilliant.
Yeah.
You've spent years of your life learning how to read and write, years learning how to speak, but what about listening? It's like breathing, right? It's funny, when I in my communication workshops, when I bring up the importance of taking a diaphragmatic breath and telling people that, look, most of you are breathing incorrectly. You just sense people being annoyed. It's like, are we going to learn breathing?
Yeah,
no. This is so stupid, right?
Yeah, I want to be a keynote speaker.
I don't want to do this. What the hell is this? Okay, I can breathe. It's all good. Let's move on, right? But it's funny because the same thing goes with listening. Same thing goes with breathing. We just think that, oh, just because you hear words doesn't actually mean you're listening, right? So the whole idea behind this one, I love it. It's that it's with another one where it says, I don't know if it was Stephen Covey. I think it was someone. Dale Carnegie, I think he said this. He said, don't aim to be interesting, be more interested, and you'll have more friends than you could ever imagine, kind of thing, right? And this is a weakness of mine because I get paid to speak.
Sort of keynote listener.
Yeah, I'm not a keynote listener. I'm a keynote speaker. So one of my biggest issues my whole life, only up until when I started, it's funny because about 5-6 years ago, one of my students in my class called me out. I still remember this moment, right? I'm here teaching Fortune 500 companies communication skills. And this executive in my class goes, hey, Vin, just wondering over the next 3 days as you're teaching on this course, are you covering what I believe is one of the most important areas of communication, active listening? And I went, no, what's that? Like, I did not have this in my repertoire.
Yeah.
Because again, I was so focused on delivery and being interesting that I didn't understand the value of being interested. And since 5 years ago, diving now into this whole realm, you know, head first, wow.
What? Communication's two ways.
I couldn't believe it. It was my version of that breathing thing happened to me. I went, I've listened. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Right? But I think the only reason why you're probably finding doing a podcast with me enjoyable is because I've learned how to listen. Before this, brother, I did not listen. I'm serious.
What do you mean? Yeah.
It was awful. It was awful ever sitting with me because I would do the four sins of being a terrible listener. One, I'd be judging you like crazy based on what you're saying. Man, this guy's an idiot. I can't believe he's talking about this stuff. Everyone knows this already. This is so stupid. Why are we talking about this on the podcast? Things like that will be running through my head while you're talking. Yeah. Second one.
They still do, but that's fine.
No, they're not. They're not. Second one is I'd one-up your stories.
Yeah.
So you tell me a story and I'll be like, well, let me tell you one. And then I'll just one-up the hell out of your stories. So I'll judge you. I'll one-up your stories. Next one. I'd immediately go into advice giving mode. I'd give you advice on how you can solve all your problems because I'm the best person at giving advice.
And how to tell a better story based on the story that you just shared. Yeah.
Well, I go straight into teacher mode and I go straight into advice mode. It's just absolutely terrible, man. Just like, and then the last one is mind reading. I try to predict what you're saying next and then I'll dive in. I'll be like, yeah, I get it. Yeah, I get it. I don't know what it's like, man. I know what it's like being Indian. I get it. And I just dive straight into it and I don't want to listen anymore.
Yeah.
It was awful, man.
Mm.
Can you relate to any of that, or have you always been a great listener?
I wasn't listening. Sorry. I was just thinking about. I just used the moments of silence to think about the next thing.
Yeah,
no, 100%. I think
Yeah. I mean, this wasn't taught. Like, what blows my mind is stuff like this is not taught. Listening, breathing, financial literacy, investing, saving.
Yeah.
No, don't worry. Learn Pythagoras. It's all good. You need to learn the unknown length of a triangle, because in life, there's got to be a moment where you're like, hey, man, this triangle writing, what is C if A is 30 centimeters?
Yeah, I know.
No, I understand that it helps us develop critical thinking, but far out, for goodness sake, we need to teach active listening.
Yeah.
We need to teach basic communication skills, literacy skills, how to learn. Far out. This is crazy. True.
Well, I just love like the example that they use in the book
where
he's having a conversation with his kid. And it's pretty much like...
Your voice has changed. I was listening, but you needed a drink of water.
I think I had a drink of water and I didn't finish that scene.
It was like, I just heard your story of your child. And then I was like, what the hell is happening? Your voice just changed.
I'm just drowning. We're about 4 hours in of recording.
But you see what you do? You tried to go on with the conversation as if nothing was different.
You never let me just continue on.
You can't not call that out.
Like when weird stuff happens, sometimes it's even better when the person just continues on.
But all of a sudden it went like that. And then you kept trying to push through. You can't do that. Don't do that with like me. I can't stand that.
I feel like you're not listening to my story.
Great time. We lost it.
Oh,
I'm so in tears.
I've got delirious.
Oh, I have tears. Look, I think next time we won't do Korean fried chicken and then go into a podcast. No, I think that was a fatal error.
Jeez.
Fatal error.
Oh, it's good.
All right, so you got your normal voice back?
I don't know.
All right, go. I'm listening.
Now I'm not talking. All right. So he uses a story pretty much where he's having a discussion with his kid. And rather than actually actively listening, he's just like autobiographing, right?
What do you mean by that?
Where, son, I remember when I was 8 years old and I had the same thing. Yep. And it's like going to just share all of my examples and go through that. And then like goes through the dialogue. And I think one of the big things at the end of that story is then looking at it and being like, to really actively listen to someone, you have to understand their frame of reference, right? And that was one of the biggest things. I'm like, how many times, like, I think when I'm on, I could be a very good listener. But I'm like, geez, when you really turn that listening into something powerful and amazing, it's when you truly understand the other person's frame of reference, right? And I think that's really easy when you're very aligned with someone and you share the same values and you know them really well. Yeah. You can kind of be like, all right, where's their state of mind right now? Like, what are they truly actually saying right now?
Mm-hmm.
And even in that example with the kid, but the kid was ultimately trying to express a fear, right? That I'm worried that I'm going to fail the test. That was what it came down to. But if you're autobiographing it, you'll never actually get to that point. Mm-hmm. And that interaction will just end with a few one-word answers. And then it's end of the conversation.
And then you walk away feeling like you're a hero.
Yeah. Or
sometimes you walk away, you're going, that was a good conversation.
Yeah. Or like deep down, you're just like, all right, well, that's over. Like we wrapped a bow on that thing. Yeah, next. And I think that probably happens in the family life a lot, right? Yeah. It's like, how's your day? Yeah, good. You know, and it's like, yeah, but there's deeper levels of it that you can then explore. And I really like that point of really finding that frame of reference and then getting on the same side as the person when you're listening, rather than going into the advice giving mode, the solving
judging,
mode. Because I'd naturally go to that as well.
Yeah, of course.
Right? It's like, oh yeah, problem solve. Let's solve it. Mm-hmm. You've shared something. We'll just get to the bottom of it and go there. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is a really cool takeaway that I really made a note about. I'm like, okay, I wanted to try to practice this a bit more and spend a bit more energy and bandwidth on.
When I think about listening now from the perspective of someone who teaches communication, I really put emphasis on the word active. You actively listen. And how do you actively listen? And you actively listen by, first of all, listening, of course, to the content and words, right? But then you've also got to listen to the mood and emotion. Mm-hmm. And that gives you the frame of reference, right? So if in that example with Stephen Covey, he was talking about, if he listened to the kid's emotion and mood, it would have been like, this is based in fear. But if you just listen to the words, you just think it's about the test. So you give advice on studying techniques. But if you listen to the mood and emotion, you would then understand the frame of reference. It's about fear. Or is it about frustration? Or is it about inadequacy? What is it? Mm-hmm. So there's two ways you can actively listen. Third way you can actively listen is with your ears, in terms of listen to the vocal changes that this person is displaying. Because the classic is, and I've done this before as well, because I was a young man and I was an idiot. I had ex-partners where I'll talk to them. I go, "Hey, how's your day?" And she's like, "Yeah, it's okay." I'm like, "Great. All right. So I'm just going to go out with the boys. I'll see you later tonight. Glad you're okay." And I'm gone. And like, she did that because she expected that I was able to listen at the vocal change level. Whereas all I was listening to was the words. And I was like, the words were, "Yeah, I'm fine."
Yeah.
And I didn't understand that you could also listen at the vocal change level. And then the fourth one you listen to is you listen with your eyes. You listen with body language. So you're fully locked in. And if you're listening to the words, emotions, and mood, you listen to the vocal changes and their body language, your brain can't do anything else but be present and actively listen. And that's when you get the full context of what that person's saying. To do that, super hard. I've been learning about it, trying to master it myself for many years. Still super hard. And just like you said, it's the hardest with the people we interact with the most. Yet that's where it matters the most. And it's the hardest in those situations.
Mm.
Yeah. It's easy to do with new people because it's new information. Sometimes it's more interesting. It's harder to do it with those that we are always around.
There's new stimulus and you're more attentive.
That's right.
You're like, you're paying more attention. I think that's the hardest thing is because it requires so much bandwidth.
That's right.
What do they say? Like only 3% of communication is is based on the words. And like,
I mean, there's been debates about that. It's been disproven. It's been proven. Look, I think.
But body language is pretty big, right?
All of it is important.
Yeah.
I think the point of it is to say all of it is important. Mm. And real quick side note, I was listening to the vocal changes of your voice. That's why I couldn't let it go.
When I was drowning.
Yeah. I was like, you can't do that. You can't do that. So I was listening because I was listening to vocal changes.
Mm.
But yeah, that's
you're a great listener.
I am.
Yeah,
I see you all.
You made me feel so good as I was drowning. As a really good listener, that was so supportive. And
hold on, I have to give the audience context as to why this is such a big deal for me. Okay, so Ali and I were at a retreat. We're doing a retreat and we're designing the lives we want to live. And this guy was holding in a fart. Okay. And he was holding in this fart. And we had inspirational music playing in the background as well. So it was like this beautiful moving moment. It's like super inspirational, instrumental, softly in the back. And Ali's giving us this incredible life kind of guidance and advice. And then all I hear is his stomach going. And you talked through it as if no stomach sounds were being made. And all of us heard the sounds. We know you heard the sound. And you kept talking like freaking Alan Watts.
Yep.
And it was driving all of us mental.
It must go on. And
the moment I called it out, everyone died laughing.
I know.
And all it was you're holding in a fart. I just said, bro, just go to the toilet.
Yeah, well, we're mid-sentence.
I know you're mid-sentence.
Hey, sorry, guys. Can I just take a moment? I just need to go over here and just fart for a second.
But that's because I'm actively listening. I'm actively listening. And there are pros and cons.
I was planning on farting once we were finished that sentence. Like, I just had to get through that little passage.
It was a long-ass sentence.
Yeah, well,
it took forever.
We're mid-session. So
we're mid-session. Yeah. But, that's just,
I don't want to break the flow.
Actively listening. I saw the discomfort in your face.
I have to make a choice, right?
Yeah.
It's like, do we lose this moment or do I fart?
But you didn't know that there was an active listener who was watching your facial expressions and see the discomfort.
I had such a good friend that wasn't going to just let this one slide.
I was so concerned for your safety.
Yeah.
So concerned.
My safety.
Dude, it's not good to hold it in.
You're going
to
burst an appendix, brother.
It's not good. Look it up.
Look it up.
Seek first to understand, then to be understood. I think that if we actively listen to other people, because of the human being's natural tendency to reciprocate, mm-hmm. I think when you do it for others, they'll do it for you.
Yep.
Yeah. I think, and when you actively listen to other people, far out, it's a nourishing experience. It's an incredibly nourishing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I've done this for certain people in my life and I can tell no one in their life actively listens to them. Because of their reaction when I do it. It's a superpower. Yeah.
Love it.
So there you go. But isn't that interesting though? Seek first to understand, then be understood.
Hmm.
Whereas how do we do it in society?
The other way.
Yeah, the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen, you just take the things that we do and you reverse them.
That's right.
That's what you're doing, aren't you, mate? Bloody hell. Genius.
We got another book. It's like Habits of Effective People 7.
Yeah.
Like equally
just
as
like
good
the reverse
book.
Of it.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. All right. One more quote I will have to throw out there from Stephen, and it's, seeking to understand requires consideration. Seeking to be understood takes courage. Yeah, yeah. So it's two different areas, yeah. But I love that. Any other ones before we move to the next one? Anything else?
Let's move.
Next one is synergize. Hmm. Balls in your court.
All right, synergy. Mm-hmm. I made a couple of real big notes around this, and I just made up a word. I'm like, it's just, the word to me is like energy that is synced mm-hmm. to multiply its impact.
So what's the word that you made up?
No, like synergy. So like made definition.
You made up a definition.
Yeah, definition. It's, it probably is very close to what the actual
synergy is. Yeah. I feel like that's what that word means.
I'm like, whoa, light bulb moment. There's not that innovator really. Right now.
Yeah, no, I'm actively listening, mate. That wasn't.
It's my version.
That wasn't,
It was my version of Stephen Covey's reversing it. And it's like, that's pretty much just the dictionary.
Yeah, you literally gave textbook answer. Yeah, you told us what was written in the book. So thank you for that, Ali.
I love it, right? Like when I think about synergy, I just think about it as a multiplier.
Yeah.
Like, how do you get so much alignment and exchange that you can really, multiply the inputs or the collaboration with other people? And for me, it's just one of those things where, like, I think it goes, this really ties nicely with win-win and having that in mind.
Yeah.
Right. Like, when you have great synergy, the win-wins only get amplified even more.
Mm-hmm.
So, synergy for me was more just all about alignment and then collaborating to multiply the impact for things.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen the power of alignment. I've seen the power of when, like again, in example, with our friendship, the fact that we've been able to align so many of our values, that's allowed us to create this podcast.
Yep.
We are here because of synergy. Mm. We do very different things in our everyday lives, but we are brought together through this synergy of the alignment in the values that we have.
Mm.
So it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And when it's organic and it's pure and it's got all of these things, the power of it's incredible, right? Like we always say it as well, like all we're doing is just really recording our normal conversations. Like people always ask, it's like, oh, do you guys prep for this? Or do you have a plan? Are you doing it? It's like, no, this is just us. Yeah, like,
you don't prep. Like, I do a little bit of prep. I mean,
it's like on a normal day.
The pages are empty. There's nothing written on there.
The book's
made. You're just pretending to point at things, but there's nothing on your page.
The book's upside down.
It's just
it's a shopping list.
You look closely and it's bananas. Carrots, bananas. Yeah, I like smoothies. My favorite color is blue.
We just write something to make it look like.
Yeah, just go, I am brilliant.
Yeah.
No, but yeah, that's true though.
Yeah. And I think that's where the coolest things happen when there's organic synergy.
Sorry.
And shopping lists.
Yeah, it's just, no. To be transparent with our listeners, this is one of the first times we've done back-to-back podcasts.
Yeah.
Normally we do 2 hours and we get on with our day. This is one of the first times we've done, two in a day.
And we're in person.
It's actually not bad. I'm feeling all right. Are you feeling all right?
Yeah, I'm feeling good.
I think the quality has probably dropped a little bit.
Yeah,
but it'll be, our listeners will let us know that.
Yeah, they'll let us know that.
Yeah, they'll let us know that.
Hopefully you get heaps of hate.
Why would you want that?
I don't know. It just came out. I was listening to you, and that's what I felt like. I thought you needed right
now. No, I didn't.
That's what you
not
wanted.
What I needed.
I don't know.
The point that you were talking about, that before we kind of went off on our little tangent, is you said that when there's that synergy, it doesn't feel forceful.
Yeah, that's right.
It doesn't feel
there's
forceful.
There's no weight.
There's no weight. And I think this is why I chose to do a podcast with one of my best friends in my life. As opposed to, because now I have the reach to be able to bring on certain key people, but I don't want to.
Is this like a flex? Where it's like a threat?
No, it's not. Yeah, it could be the Vin and Anyone show at this point. No, but it's. I don't want to do that because how many podcasts have you listened to where two people are sitting across from each other and there's no synergy? And then it's so... I don't know how to describe it. It's just so forceful. It's like you can tell that there's no rapport. You can tell that the other person's uncomfortable. And it's so painful to listen to those. And I didn't want to create another podcast that's just going to add another one of those to the world.
Yeah.
So there's something beautiful about relationships that have a lot of synergy and alignment. Mm. But the thing is, so if a listener's listening to this and going, damn it, I don't have many relationships in my life where there's a lot of alignment and synergy. What do? we don't know. Yeah. Yeah, you gave me that look. I read your body language in your eyes.
What?
Yeah, you just gave me the look of, I don't know, do you know? Are we gonna, what are we going to say?
Is this a rhetorical question that you're now going to answer?
No, no, I wanted an answer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm stretching your thinking outside of your comfort zone. If you had to build relationships that had more synergy and had more alignment, how would you do it?
I think it's putting yourself into environments where you can find, I think it's based on values, right? You said it before. Like we have.
Well, you got to know what your values are first.
That's right.
You've got to know what your values are with clarity.
Correct.
So that when you meet people who don't have the same values, it's very easy for you to identify that so that you go, hey, that person's not a good fit, not a good fit for my life at the moment. It's all good. Nothing personal. Just, hey, we've got different values. It's all good.
I'm a bit of a believer as well that every single person will have people in their environment and ecosystem that they do have synergy with.
Yeah.
To some level. Right? Oh, like, is it now at the level where they need to start a podcast?
Probably not.
Probably not.
Probably not.
Right? But there'll be that exchange. And I think the way that I went through here, I think it's around passions and communities and hobbies.
Mm, yeah.
Right? So you can put yourself into situations where you increase your chances of finding synergy with people. Like, I think back to school, right? And school's the greatest example because you just put into a melting pot of so many different people. And organically, you generally get attracted to the people that you're going to have synergy with.
Yeah.
You know, different classes, different friendship groups.
Mm.
You play sports together, whatever it is. So I think the clues already exist when we're kids.
Yeah.
But then as adults, we maybe don't really invest as much time into trying to create relationships that have high levels of synergy as we get older. Right. And it's probably the reason why so many of us, like us, a lot of our best friends are still from when we're at high school and we're at uni, right? And they're amazing relationships and they're already backed with such strong synergy that's happened from all the experiences that we shared when we were kids. You never take that away.
Yeah.
But then I think as we get older, it's also important to then find other relationships that also have that level of synergy just to rejuvenate things and to expand your thinking on certain things too.
When I think about this and I think about how are you going to get more relationships that are more aligned, again, I think it's value driven. If you can be around people who have the same values as you, that's very important.
Yeah.
So what you have to learn how to do as well is be a beacon. Mm. If you don't act out your values in your life and your values are just things you hold on the inside and no one knows that these are your values, then you're not a beacon. So someone walking right past you who has the same set, very similar set of values to you, they just walk straight past you, don't even recognize that you are one of them, one of their kind, and that they would love to be around you. Beautiful friendship could have occurred. But because you didn't live out and act out your values, you're not a beacon. No one sees it. You walk straight past each other, two cars in the middle of the night. No one knows, right? So to me, it's about you joining places where there are lots of people doing something that you're passionate about, but then you also have to act out those values.
Yeah.
Act out those values, live out those values. And you become this kind of magnet where people who have similar values will come close to you. Not to say that we should also just abandon people who have different values to us. It's very important to have people around us who have different values to us. Otherwise, echo chamber, right? So be very conscious of the echo chamber because you and I are always going to think, I'm always going to think you're brilliant, right? And you probably will think I'm brilliant a lot of the times. You tend to always think I'm brilliant. I don't always think you're brilliant, but we have that like echo chamber happening, right?
Yeah.
And we've just got to be super careful of that because I think it's dangerous if everyone around you thinks the exact same way because then there's just five versions of you.
Yeah. Great synergy though.
A little bit sickening though.
Really good synergy in those environments.
That's why I dislike you a little bit just to add a little bit of that. Yeah, just to break it up a little bit. You need it. I'm not doing it because I don't like you. Doing it because I care.
it's from a place of love.
Yeah, from a place of love. Yeah,
I get that.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome though. I love what you said there around. It's nearly, you have to market yourself.
Yeah, you got to wear it on your sleeve. Wear your values.
It's branding, right? The sort of image I got then was the dating profile. It's like how much effort gets put into portraying yourself in a certain light so you can be a beacon.
That's right.
But we don't really do that. Maybe for job applications we do with a resume and a cover letter, but it's like how do you then also take those same principles in other areas of your life where it's not weird?
and I'll say one last thing on this because we want to move to the last one as well before we close out the pod. But it's, if you don't do this, if you don't act out your values, then the danger that you have is you may not attract incredible humans into your life that could potentially change your life and quality of life.
For sure.
Because they could be around you right now and you just don't even know it. But because you don't act those out, you're invisible. Mm. Yeah. Because imagine we didn't act out our values, we didn't cross paths, man, we would have missed out on a freaking wicked friendship. Yeah. So
I love this line that he wrote. It's in a different section of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But he's like, maturity is the balance between courage and consideration. Mm. Right. And I think that links to synergy as well.
Wow.
It's like when you get to know yourself a little bit better and you increase in that maturity.
Mm.
I love that.
That's so powerful.
Right. It's like the balance between courage and consideration.
Wow.
And I think they're the big ones, is when you do find that person that you need to go and reach out to.
Have the courage.
Like, and hopefully you're at the point in your life where like the maturity is at a nice level where you can communicate it well enough as well. Yeah. So you have the consideration of where they are and their time in life, but then you also have a bit of courage to go for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And to give it a go too. And I think that's where we sometimes, it's a timing thing that we get wrong.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, 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 I think we would have had great synergy, but sorry, I just wasn't at the point in my life where I could have communicated that well enough. And it's finding that. You know, I think you spoke about it in one of the other episodes where you're like, even when you're emulating people, don't go 3-4 steps ahead, right?
Yeah.
But like, the synergy is probably not going to be there.
Mm.
But one step ahead or the same sort of step, you're increasing your chances.
The final one.
Final one.
Sharpen the saw.
Sharpen the saw.
You're basically repeating what I'm saying.
That's it.
Yeah. We're at the point of this area. Yeah.
Just got into that group thing that you're speaking about, the echo chamber.
Echo chamber.
Literally the echo chamber. Right.
Thank you. Well, I'm sure you did that as an example of the dangers of an echo chamber. Thank you for that, Ali. That
was, really, really makes a podcast super shit.
Sharpening the saw. And Stephen talks about sharpening the saw. There's four key areas you should sharpen the saw with, right? There are four different saws you've got to sharpen in your life. One is within the physical dimension. Second is the spiritual dimension. Third is the mental dimension. And the final is social and emotional dimension. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of four saws in life you want to sharpen, you know, and keep fairly sharp. Let's talk about it.
Mm. I like it. I think it's one of the things I wrote earlier on in the year is, rather than having like a really big vision statement or value statement, I had three words that are a circle that was pretty big out of our early life design session earlier in the year. And that was dreams, goats, and sharpen. Right? Now, dreams are obviously around like, trying to impact the dreams, my own dreams, and then also the dreams of others that I care about.
Interesting.
Goats was just the greatest of all times.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so engaging and just observing masters of their crafts, getting really good intelligence, you know, observing great art, experiencing some of the cooler things in the world. And then sharpen was ultimately about this. And I loved reading this chapter because it just sort of reminded me of putting that in the frame where it's like, you know, sharpen my mind, my body, my spirit. And this added the fourth one, which was also emotions. Right?
The one you always leave out.
That old chestnut. The unimportant one. That that
I'm a man. I have no emotions.
Like realistically in the book as well, he didn't really describe it. He's just like, go back to habit 4 and 5. So even I don't think he really had this one figured out.
Whereas
the other three had some pretty good examples and concrete examples where he's like, I've gotten a 4 and I'm just going to kick this one off. But I think that to me is like, a bit of a holistic view of how I'm approaching
it's a beautiful framework.
This year and just a little bit of a framework. And I think sharpening is just a really cool concept in terms of it actually helps all of the others as well, right? Because if I'm sharp in mind, body, spirit,
emotion,
I'm going to be able to probably
miss out emotion again.
Emotion. there's a job for a psychologist there that's just ready to go. But then I think it also amplifies, you know, the ability to impact the dreams of, you know, mine and also the others. And it kind of works as a bit of a cycle, a flywheel that feeds each other. But, and then I just made some notes around those four areas around what does that actually look like in a really simple framework?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, all right, so physical is just exercise, right? So one of the things that I've got as a bit of a daily reminder is I just want 200 active kilojoules every single day.
That's pretty good.
I don't care what it is.
Yeah.
It's a number that's not massive.
Yeah.
It's also small. Sometimes that can be achieved, like I just use the Apple Watch, start workout, and that can be achieved sometimes in just 8 minutes.
Go for a walk.
20-minute walk, whatever it is, playing cricket with the kids. It's like there's multiple ways to get this. It's not even tied into like have to go to the gym 5 times a week or whatever it is, right? The second one is spirit, and that's just around meditation, right? Do either a minimum 1 cycle of Wim Hof breathing or a
day?
Yeah, or a 10-minute transcendental meditation or mantra meditation or calm app or whatever it's going to be.
Okay.
That's in there. And then mind, I journaling and planning. So just allocating time, like either a daily journal entry, which it's a pretty embedded habit of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, emotion, question mark. But it was more around, I think what I really put there was win-win.
Yeah.
And I actually did take the idea of the habits and understanding. Like, I think emotions are about, it's deeper connection, right?
Yeah. So as understanding other people.
That's right. And yourself.
Yeah.
You know, so having that combination there of both.
Yeah.
And probably just expressing a little bit more of what that is. Like, you know, one of the exercises is like, all right, what's your body actually feeling like?
Mm.
What's going on right now? And just being a little bit more aware on that side. And I can probably tie that one in with journaling a fair bit too. So that was kind of my approach to a really simplified version or a relatively simplified version of sharpening the saw in multiple ways.
Yeah.
And the total time allocation to do all of those on, say, even the busiest day could be 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes, realistically, right?
Okay.
You could do a quick journal entry.
Mm-hmm.
One Wim Hof cycle takes that's 30 breaths. It mm-hmm. takes about a minute and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And the exercise can be 5 to 10 minutes,
depending
on the intensity.
I love how simple it is.
Mm.
I just built mine out a little more.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. I mean, for physical, I just wrote down eat well.
Yeah.
And then I also got the exercise component, which is go for a walk. Mm. You know, we've got the apartment now, so I want to go for a walk in the city. We've got a beautiful River Torrens here. And just build it into my lifestyle as opposed to try to have quick fixes. The way I've always approached physical is like, I've got to do this. I'm like, you know, I'm going to build it into my lifestyle now where 3 times a week I'll go for a big walk with Pei Wen, right? The spiritual dimension, similar to you, is the daily meditation, but I really want to connect with nature more. You know, one of the reasons I love camping so much is because we're out in nature. Mm-hmm. So an unlock for me was we've got the Botanic Gardens here in South Australia. So I just want to spend a little bit more time there to grow more spiritually, because if there's any bucket that I'm really shit in, it's that one.
And you can do both there, right?
Yeah.
That's walking, well, that's double, your exercise.
Yeah. You can double it up, right? That's really cool. The mental dimension, I got what you said as well, the journaling part, but also wrote down, read some good literature.
Yeah, learning.
Learning, right? It's good for the mind. And I really want us to do a podcast this year on a book that we know nothing about, like something like astrophysics or something, and just read it and just see how we get through that. And then it'll be really fun.
Why do you have your shopping list again?
This is the way. I can see corn. So it'll be really cool to do that, because I think that pushes us to grow mentally.
Yeah.
Yeah, something completely different. So that'll be a super fun episode. I'm really excited about that.
Sounds super fun.
The emotional dimension is I want to learn how to understand other people more and at a deeper level. And also do something that's really meaningful for society. Mm. I'm doing a talk later this year in April for Asian community in Sydney to try to reframe the conversation that's I see happening. You know, sometimes it can be a little bit of, oh, it's us versus them. It's like, no, it's just us.
Yeah.
Right. So trying to do something that's a little more, of realm, a bit more contribution.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Love it.
And I think the reason it's called sharpen the saw is when you sharpen all of these saws, guess what's going to happen? Mm. You can cut down trees faster. You achieve your goals quicker. So to me, this is the... if you get this right, you are more effective. It's not just about being more efficient. This one is about being more effective. And instead of taking 300 or 3,000 back and forth motions to cut down this tree, you can do it in 17. Mm-hmm. Back and forth motions is done. Whereas I think a lot of the times, again, just if you're listening to this and you're someone who you feel like you're just pedaling nonstop and you're not able to get where you want to go, maybe your saw is blunt. You know, so it's about, this book really just reminded me of the period of my life where I wasn't getting anywhere. And it's because my axe was, or my saw was completely blunt.
Yep.
Yeah. So just quick few things to check on. And don't be expected to be good at all of it, because if I judge myself, I'm only good at the mental dimension. Mm-hmm. Spiritual, physical, emotional. Yeah. I'm not bad at that one, but yeah.
Yep.
Don't be too hard on yourself.
That's right. Very good.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Mm. So those are the 7 habits of highly effective people.
They are the 7 habits.
Mm.
Very good.
Last question for you.
Mm.
Anything you felt that this was missing? And I just want a quick answer from you, and I'll share a quick one too. from all your years of experience?
Yeah.
Is there anything that is missing here?
I don't know if there's anything like, it's so hard, right, with every book, because there's, obviously there's going to be heaps of shit missing
in all of them. True.
What I will say is, though, I think that we talk about upgrading our operating systems.
Oh, I was about to talk about that. Yep.
And I think holistically, if you're someone that needs change in your life, or you do feel like what you just mentioned there, you're in a little bit of a rut.
Yeah.
This book is such a great starting point. Good. Do you now thinking about how am I going to reprogram myself and build an operating system? Right? Like the biggest thing that I think about every single one of these lessons is that they're fundamental principles and they allow you to be a lot more purposeful in the way that you approach life. Mm-hmm. Right? And this is why I think this book has just stood the test of time.
Yeah.
It's because even if you implement just intentions within this book, 20% of them, it's going to have a dramatic impact on your life. And they do hold up. Like most of them, even though there are some can be a little bit vague and a little bit airy fairy at times, they're very strong pillars as guideposts to be able to change your behaviors and attitudes and approaches.
So you took that in a different direction that I didn't think you were going to go in. But what I was going to just say that I felt that was missing, you know, of course, everything's going to be missing something. Yeah. It's not a judgment. It's just one that I was shocked that it wasn't there upon revisiting this. Learning how to learn. Mm. That's pretty critical.
Yeah.
I really feel like people who are very effective understand how to learn. So when they do something and it doesn't work, they know how to learn to be able to do that the second time or the third time or the fourth time and then become successful.
Yeah.
So that's all I was going to say. Yeah. Like learning how to learn, I think it's a critical thing. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining us for this episode of 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do consider jumping on and giving us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a shout out on social media. I'm at AskVin, AskVinh, and Ali?
At Ali Tarai.
Spell it out.
No idea how to. Aliterai.
Wasn't a funny joke. So no, thanks, everyone. So
we're late.
Ali's completely out of energy. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you in another episode real soon.
Hello, it's Vin. Thank you so much for listening to the Vin and Ali Show. We've created something that we're really excited about and we want to share it with you. It's called Recalibrate. It's a 12-step process that helps you create more clarity and more alignment in your life. It's the exact approach that both Ali and I have been using to live happier lives and to achieve all of our wildest dreams in the last 7 years. It's been crazy. Being one of our loyal listeners, we wanted to share a special something with you. Visit recalibrate.online/Vin and Ali to access the course for 70% off. I hope you will check it out.